The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
I guess that was the ship's bell there, signaling that Mr. Kokel has left the ship, and he's back in the talk show host's chair here. Stand to reason, and glad to be with you today. Thank you so much for joining me for our show. Got in late last night. Not late, I don't know, 10 o'clock. Back home here in Southern California from our STR Caribbean cruise. What my four-year-old called the Stand to Reason Caribbean. Now, 10 o'clock last night, that would be 1 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast, which is the time we were operating on. So I guess I did get in late. And then up this morning in time to kind of have a cup of coffee, go over my material, drive down to the studio to have this time to share with you. So I am looking forward to our conversations over the next 3 hours on anything that you have in mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. If you want to talk with me, actually only the first 2 hours will be open for calls because I'm going to have a conversation with Tom. Is it Gilson, right? G-I-L, not Gilson, Tom Gilson, who I actually have met a number of times, and he has prepared a book that's available to you in response to the Reason Rally in Washington, D.C. yesterday with the atheists, 20,000 of them or so, gathered. And I'll be talking about that in just a moment. But point being, I'll be talking with him the third hour, and you'll be listening in. You won't be able to participate, so that means these first 2 hours are yours to converse with me. 1-800-227-5278 is the number if you're in the 714 area code. 754-4150 is the local dial-up. And I want to talk to you in the second hour a little bit more about the cruise, which is a tremendous amount of fun. And I think a productive use of our time for Stand to Reason and our STR speakers who are all there. But let's save that to this for the second hour. I wanted to touch base with you, what I consider my more insider group, the first hour. It's not the national broadcast. It's the folks that are listening primarily in the Southern California footprint, where I've been for now 23 years, and also those who are listening on podcast. And so I want to talk a little bit about this Reason Rally yesterday in Washington, D.C. I have two pieces, one from the USA Today and the other from CNN, that were written about it. And I just have some reflections that I want to make. And then in our third hour, we'll be talking in more detail about that with Tom Gilson and the book that he is responsible for called True Reason, that you can get for $3, truereason.org. It's a e-book. But it's a fabulous book. We'll be discussing that more the third hour. But I do want to say something about the rally in general, and thought I'd kick off by reading some of these accounts, or at least portions of it. We were traveling, by the way, the whole day yesterday, so I just wasn't in touch with any of this happening as it happened. But apparently there are 20,000 atheists that gathered in the mall there in Washington, D.C., for what they called a Reason Rally, which Kathy Lynn Grossman of USA Today characterizes as an effort, and I'm quoting here, damning religion and mocking beliefs. She writes, Richard Dawkins, who is one of the speakers, a six-hour-long rally in the rain. People just stayed out there, really strong convictions about this, which is fine. You're not going to get any abuse from me about this, but I do want to reflect on some of the sentiments that were communicated there. Richard Dawkins, one of the so-called new atheists, biologist from Cambridge, no, make that Oxford, The God Delusion, one of his more famous works, critiquing theism in general, Christianity in particular. He was there towards the end, gave his speech along with many others that were part of that enterprise. He calls on the crowd, and I'm reading from Grossman's piece in the USA Today online version here, at least, which, by the way, has a headline, Richard Dawkins to Atheist Rally, Show Contempt for Faith. All right. Dawkins got to the part where he calls on the crowd not only to challenge religious people, but to, and now she quotes from him, ridicule and show contempt, close quote. That's the Dawkins quote, but reading from the article, for their doctrines and sacraments, including the Eucharist, which Catholics believe becomes the body of Christ during Mass. Now, I guess I'm just not sure I understand this with regards to its role at a Reason rally. Now, of course, the Reason rally is this expression of the atheist's conviction that the atheistic materialistic point of view is the one that comports best with reason. They have reason on their side, and those who are religious folk do not. Therefore, the religious people who make their faith statements are not only inconsistent with reason, but therefore probably wrong, and those on the side of reason are probably right. Well, where is the place for showing contempt and ridicule for doctrines and sacraments? But why doesn't Dawkins say, and maybe he did because I didn't read the entire comments, but if I were him, I wouldn't say something like this, because it sounds to me like that kind of challenge comes from weakness. Here's how to deal with the opposing side. Make fun of them. Now, that certainly isn't on the rational side of the list. Now, some atheists might say, well, Christians, religious people make fun of atheists all the time. Well, that may be true, but that's not a rational response. And if I'm advancing a rational response to issues like this, I'm not going to encourage Christians to ridicule those who disagree. Anybody who listens to the show knows that I don't do that as a rule. I guess I've fallen into it on occasion, but I don't think that's the right way to respond. I'm on the reason side. I'm in favor of reason rallies, but because of that, I would never give this kind of encouragement. Make fun of those people who disagree. But this does seem to be characteristic, at least a part of the approach or the strategy of those on the other side. And I'm not quite sure I understand, given the commitment to reason, why this is the case. Now, I do understand from a rhetorical perspective, because these folks are really good in the use of rhetoric. That is language that is meant to persuade, regardless of whether the language is, whether the points that are made are reasonable. I'm not claiming right now that they are or not. I'm just saying, regardless of whether the atheist points are reasonable, they are using rhetoric for the sake of persuasion. They're good at it. By the way, there are theists that are good at it too. And if they are using rhetoric for the sake of persuasion instead of arguments, then I think they're making a mistake there as well. Because a person who understands how rhetoric works and how it can manipulate is going to distrust the point of view that seems to be advanced not based on reasonable arguments, but based on rhetoric. Now, maybe somebody who listened to all of the speeches yesterday can isolate for me the arguments that were advanced in favor of atheism and against religion. But I would not be surprised if there weren't that many of those, even at a Reason rally, because as I have surveyed the work of these, the champions of reason, my honest assessment is that there is precious little attempt at reasoning in advancing their view. Now, notice that I am not saying their reasoning doesn't go through, their arguments aren't ultimately adequate for their point, which is why I'm a theist. I'm not weighing in on whether theism or atheism is true or not. I am simply describing the way the ideas are advanced. I could make the same criticism of certain kinds of Christians who are advancing their ideas, which I might think to be true, in an inappropriate way or in a way that's not consistent with thoughtful engagement or thoughtful reflection regarding evidence and conclusions. And my observation, regardless of whether I think atheism is true or false, is that the arguments or the points or the attempts put forward by atheists have not been characterized by rational discourse, which I take to be facts and evidence pressed into service of a particular conclusion in a way that is rationally sound or reasonably done. That is, you are properly concluding from your evidence, your conclusion. You are not making use of informal fallacies like straw man, circular reasoning, condescension, ad hominem, genetic fallacy. And these are things we've talked about here on the show and will continue to do so. But if somebody is making a reasonable case, then they are not trading on these things. Now, ad hominems are attacks on the person. That would be the recommendation made, apparently, by Richard Dawkins to ridicule and show contempt for. By the way, that's not a rational approach. There may be rational approaches he employs, but this is not one of them. My observation is that this is what I run into most of the time. Let me continue with the article. Outrage was the parlance of the day, however, for many speakers, including David Silverman, who is Reason Rally organizer and American Atheists president. In a thundering call for, quote, zero tolerance, close quote. In other words, those apparently are his words, according to this writer. In a thundering call for zero tolerance for anyone who disagrees with or insults atheism, Silverman proclaims, stand your ground. It's not entirely clear what zero tolerance means. It isn't clearly a call for reasonable discourse with those who disagree with atheism or insult atheism. He doesn't say that. With a thundering call for addressing the challenges of atheism with thoughtful, reasonable discourse and evidence, he just simply says zero tolerance. Apparently, there were some Christians at this event. As I understand, they were invited, this particular group. The article says, meanwhile, 12 men with big signs warning Jesus demands repentance ignored the official holding pen fenced off for counter demonstrators. Instead, they stood on the grass about 100 yards from the podium, each surrounded by a knot of eager to argue unbelievers. So these are Christians that show up for one-on-one discussion. I know there was an attempt to try to silence that by these defenders of reason and have those who disagree with them ushered off to the First Amendment pen. In other words, this is a place that you can go, a fenced-in area away from everybody else where you can express your First Amendment rights to disagree. Doesn't that sound odd? I remember going to the Orange County Fair once, and there was, as I'm going in, there's a little fenced-in area. You know, it's like 20 by 50, all fenced in with a gate, and it's called the First Amendment area or something like that. That is, if you want to exercise your rights of free speech, you can go into this cage and talk all you want about what you have opinions about, but you can't go out there where the people are and have that conversation. Anyway, the article from CNN, Dan Marika, was more friendly than this piece from the USA Today. And here it says, and here David Silverman is being quoted, "We will never be closeted again." David Silverman, the rally's head organizer. "In years to come, the Reason Rally will be seen as the beginning of the end to the religious rights grip on American life." Now, the quote ends after the word grip, so apparently he's referring to American life there, this writer concludes, but I just struck me as so odd. Again, this is the guy, the Reason Rally's head organizer, David Silverman, and he is claiming that the religious right has a grip on American life. And I just, one of the foundational principles of careful thinking is getting one's facts right. Okay? Now, I understand at rallies like this, there's certain kind of a rhetorical flair that you can give some tolerance for. You know, people overstate things. But to say that the religious right has a grip on American life and the atheists want to end that, show me where the religious right has this grip on American life. It certainly isn't in the media. It certainly isn't in the academy, where the vast majority of professors are irreligious and even atheists. The religious right isn't controlling that. It isn't controlling Hollywood. It isn't controlling they aren't the gatekeepers of society, for goodness sake. Now, I can understand that atheists feel like the odd man out, since statistically they make up only about 2% of the population, and that maybe it takes a little courage for them to come out, to use their term, of the closet. But for goodness sake, to say that America, that the religious right has a grip on America, which abortion without limits is the law of the land, in which homosexuality is being promoted aggressively on every single front. This is the America that the religious right has a grip on. So this is, shall we say, playing a little bit fast and loose with the facts. The article goes on to talk about the idea of thousands of atheists gathering actually drew ire of religious groups and members of the Westboro Baptist Church, a controversial group known for picketing and protesting at funerals of U.S. service members, were in attendance and chanted at the rally goers. I will produce some evidence in the third hour here today that shows that that particular group was actually invited to be there by the leadership of the Reason Rally. Now, one wonders why they would be invited where others were told not to show up and do their proselytizing. And it just seems that they were invited for the rhetorical appeal. So let's bring the most bizarre Christians we can think of. Let's invite them to show up and look weird. And anybody that really wants to have a reasonable conversation at our Reason Rally, they're not invited. But think about this comment here in this CNN article by Dan Merica. Again, the idea of thousands of atheists gathering drew the ire of religious groups. Now, maybe it drew the ire of the Westboro Baptist Church. I can't imagine, frankly, that on balance that this makes religious people angry. Oh, man, I can't believe those atheists are getting together and assembling and having a rally. That really makes me mad. It doesn't make me mad, and I'm sure it makes no one I know angry. I think this is just a caricature, frankly, that's not sound. Continuing in the article, Silverman had said prior to the event that the rally would not be an exercise in religion bashing, but in a number of instances, religion and the belief in God was, in fact, denounced. Apparently somebody had a wooden cross constructed in the middle of the crowd with a sign on it that read, "Banish the Ten Commandments to the dustbin of history." Is that what they really want? I mean, isn't this the crowd, just a reflection here, that claims they can be good without God? Now, maybe this is just some radical in the midst of them that doesn't represent everybody else's belief, but at least with regards to this person, do they really want to ban commandments like thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal? You should honor your father and your mother. You should not lie. You should not covet your neighbor's wife or his possessions. Do they want those commandments to be banished to the dustbin of history? And what would the culture look like if they got their way? Doesn't that strike you as odd? In any event, look, if it bleeds, it leads, and it might be that the CNN crowd were just digging around trying to find the most bizarre thing they can at this atheist rally. But look, just in my own reflections, what I'm reading here, these two articles from USA Today online and CNN online about what happened yesterday and what was said yesterday is not inconsistent in any way with my experience from the writings of these people who champion reason, but for the most part do not display it. Now, I'm going to go to calls in just a minute, you know, and you're all queued up here, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you. I got so much more I can say about this. We will cover some of this in the last hour, but the point that I'm simply making, and this is not an ad hominem. I am not just trying to speak ill of people who are atheists. I am making an observation that those who champion reason in favor of atheism have not characteristically advanced reasons for atheism. They have not advanced arguments for atheism. And they have not demonstrated that sound arguments, or they haven't even attempted to say they haven't demonstrated sound arguments against theism means that I am drawing conclusions about the legitimacy of the conclusion. And what I mean to be doing here is just make an observation about the process. I don't see it happening. Instead, what I see for the most part is ridicule, condescension, circular reasoning, genetic fallacy, ad hominems, and straw man. These are all informal fallacies that every one of these smart people, and they are smart, ought to be able to recognize immediately. And I will say, on the other hand, and this may sound self-serving, you can make whatever judgment you want on it, as I have surveyed the ways that people in the fellowship that I belong to of Christian apologists have advanced their views, characteristically, they have advanced very clear and precise arguments with premises and conclusions. They have advanced arguments. They have considered rejoinders to the arguments and answered the rejoinders. And they have done so in a very clear fashion and have not, by contrast, been given to ridicule, contempt, condescension, circular reasoning, genetic fallacies, ad hominems, or straw men. Could they? Have they? Yeah, I guess on occasion. It's not characteristic. Indeed, what I have seen, and this is what stuns me more than anything else, regardless of the conclusions you draw about these issues, what has been advanced has been characteristically, with regards to religious issues, particularly Christianity, grace, reason, evidence, conclusions, and what has been advanced by the so-called brights, the reason crowd, has been nothing akin to that. Now, maybe they can do better, and if somebody wants to point out the kinds of works that they in which they offer this, fine. I have most of them. And I'm not saying no arguments have been offered, but characteristically, this is not the case, especially in public discourse. Okay, break time, and then your calls here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800-2-REASON to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. How can we give students confidence that our Bibles have not been changed over time? Find out on this month's Bulletproof Podcast. You can download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Show Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Real Reason Rally. And I can say that with a straight face without condescension. This is what we do here. Greg Kokel, your host on Stand to Reason. My comment, in contrast to the atheists' Reason Rally yesterday, and I am happy to respectfully engage atheists and have done so many times in the show. But I, as I mentioned, as a summary of my opening comments, my experience has not been that the atheists advance reason as their foundation for their view. Ask an atheist who are kind of a part of this new atheist wave, especially these more aggressive folks, ask them for their reasons, their rational argument against God. And you know what their standard response is? We don't have to give any because we as atheists do not believe there is no God. We have no belief in a God. And since our belief is a non-belief, it doesn't require any support. Well, this is, I've talked about this before. This is an completely intellectually dishonest statement. You know, you have three, rationally, you have three approaches to a proposition. Given the proposition God exists, you can deny it, you can affirm it, or you can withhold judgment. They don't affirm it, and they don't withhold judgment. They think the statement is false. That means they have a point of view, for goodness sake. And to act like they have no belief to defend, then, is dishonesty, not consistent with rationality. Anyway, enough of that. Let's get to your calls. And Tony's first on board here in Hickory, North Carolina. Tony, glad you called. Greg Kokel, hi.
Oh, hi, Greg. You hear me?
Yeah, sure.
Wow, yeah.
You were at the Reason Rally, apparently, right?
Yeah, we did. We took a group with Rocio Christi from UNC Greensboro.
Uh-huh.
I'm with a group over at Lenoir University in North Carolina and then University of Charlotte. We had about 23 people, students and leaders that went up there.
Did you just kind of blend in with the crowd and try to engage people in conversations, or did you carry signs, or what was your approach here?
Oh, no, we weren't there to protest at all, so we were there to go ahead and interact.
Sure, right. Okay, that's what I assumed from a Rocio Christi group, but I just wanted to get clear on that.
No, we definitely didn't want to do that. There were some Christians there with signs protesting.
Uh-huh.
Didn't see the Westboro Baptist folks per se. I heard they were a little some distance away from the rally.
Yeah. Incidentally, let me just say for the record that I think it's a great idea that you guys were there, Tony, and I also think it was a great idea that you didn't go as a protest, because I don't understand the rationale of protesting an atheist rally. They can rally. That's fine. In fact, it's great that they're all in one spot because we got a high target audience. Then we can go and interact. And so what you guys did was the right thing. When we go with protest with signs, it's easy to make that look ridiculous, especially the signs aren't always well worded and whatever. And so, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. If Christians look ridiculous, which is why, by the way, I think the Westboro Baptist crowd was actually invited, according to my understanding, to that event. They want them to look ridiculous. So why should we play into that stereotype? Do what you guys did. Let's mingle and have conversations. So how did it go?
It seemed to be very effective. We had some wonderful conversations. We were in teams of two. We were a little concerned about how we would be treated, and we were even threatened with, you know, potentially being arrested and not being there. But we
By the way, I can't imagine. I know that this was a threat, but why would anybody be arrested for being on the public property in the mall speaking about their beliefs, having conversation?
It was a threat. It was a threat, but we really didn't have any problem. Although there were some definitely militant atheists there, we tried to go ahead and direct our interactions with those that looked like they were willing to go ahead and talk without just getting into an argument. That was really successful. And again, many of us felt more comfortable. We're one-on-one throughout the crowd, and that was often the safest, to have a one-on-one interaction with someone.
Well, good. By the way, are you on a speakerphone?
No.
Oh, okay. Because you seem a little distant. If you could just watch.
There, is that better?
Yeah, if you stand a little closer to your mouthpiece, I don't know. Just seemed a little distant there for a moment. So, what was the nature of your conversations, or what did you discover about at the Reason Rally as you went there as a Christian theist follower of Christ to reason with people about those issues? What did you discover from those at the Reason Rally who were atheists, at least the ones you engaged?
You know, it varied. It really varied. There were a lot of different people there. There were, of course, a lot of zealous atheists from a lot of different organizations,
mm-hmm.
more organizations than I knew existed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprised to find out that so many of them came from great distances. We interacted from people from, you know, Kansas, Canada, Texas, mm-hmm. you know, New Jersey. I think more people were from outside of the D.C. area, some distance, than actually were nearby.
Yeah, well, that's part of the point of having something at D.C., because the idea there is this is meant to be the place where a nationally represented enterprise happens. And so I think the idea was to draw from the national crowd. So that doesn't actually surprise me.
Yeah, well, it was definitely a national crowd there. But it really varied. There were a lot of people that were came because their atheist friends drugged them along. I interacted with a couple of like that they really were more agnostic or just coming to check things out because they heard about it, but weren't really engaged or directly involved with an atheist association.
Mm-hmm.
And those were great because, you know, talking with those individuals, we could have a real reasonable conversation and we could share information. About some of them had some Christian upbringing,
mm-hmm.
But walked away, never really were convinced
mm-hmm.
Of anything and walked away as adults, but were willing to go ahead and hear arguments, reasoned arguments for faith. And
mm-hmm.
it was wonderful to provide that for them. Some of them we did pass out the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, to individuals that seemed real receptive and might be able to follow up, and that was great. I was
mm-hmm.
really glad that we had that resource, thanks to Rasha Christie National.
Right, that's Frank Turek and Norm Geisler's book, which I think is a really great book. Single-volume book of apologetics. It does a great job mm-hmm. of answering a lot of these challenges, so that's good.
So
and we had a lot of copies of True Reason as well, the first chapter anyway.
Right. Now, is that in print? Because I got mine kind of a Kindle version or the e-book version. And
I believe it's in hard copy, and you can get it at Barnes & Noble and other sources now, but we just gave a hard copy of the first chapter.
Yeah.
Is a teaser.
Okay, well, that's great. I'm looking forward to getting a hard copy myself. At my third hour, I'll have a conversation with Tom Gilson, who's the editor and contributor to that particular
great.
Book.
It was great editors. To see him there. Early.
Let me ask you though before I let you go. What would you say? I mean, did you listen to any of the public presentations, or were you mostly engaged in conversations with individuals? Did you hear Richard Dawkins or Bill Maher or any of the others that were scheduled?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. We were there mingling with the crowd, and some people were more intent on listening. Those two people you mentioned in particular, most people it wasn't appropriate to engage in conversation with them while they were speaking.
Yes.
Those kind of bigger headliners, because people were really engaged.
Sure.
And then we could listen to what they had to say and then ask people questions about a particular comment that was made, or do you agree with what was said, and kind of follow up with those kind of questions.
Okay,
again,
well, let me ask you.
Tactics book was something we really definitely tried to follow, asking
questions. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And certainly in a situation like that, I think that's going to be most effective. I have a question, though, about the speeches. And do your best to be kind of even-handed here. I know you would be, but I have to ask that so listeners think you're concentrating on it. And that is, would you say that you – and my question now is not whether the claims or the arguments – went through, were effective or compelling to you. I'm just asking, on balance, do you think that most of the information that was offered were examples of thoughtful reasoning about the issue of God and religion, or was really examples of informal fallacies, like I mentioned earlier, contempt, ad hominem, genetic fallacy, straw man, that kind of stuff? What was your take, at least, on what was offered to the audience?
Well, I'll give you kind of what I heard, and also echoing comments I heard from a lot of our college students that were there, was that they were surprised that there wasn't really much argumentation given. It was really more of a pep rally, and there really wasn't argumentations on why you should be an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really hardly see much given there at all. Although you talked about religious bashing and ridicule, that was pretty pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more of a pep rally. Excite the troops. And there wasn't a lot of information given. And again, I think I just briefly heard you mention that they think they don't have to give an argument.
Yeah.
They really don't have anything that they need to support. So in our discussions,
right,
it was usually one-sided.
Yeah, but that is their default position for many of them, and a lot of people are picking up on this. They're redefining the word atheism to mean I have no belief in a God, and therefore I have no belief to defend. There is no burden of proof on me. And and that, I think, itself is an intellectually dishonest move. But even so, it just strikes me that at a Reason rally where they're championing their commitment to reason, that you'd expect a little bit more reason in display, that is a reasonable approach to this issue rather than a lot of these other things. I mean, can you imagine if we had an apologetics conference, which we do, you know, lots of them, which the whole idea is to give a reasonable defense for your faith, and we spent the majority of time just putting down and condemning other people? I know you've been to those events. I'm sure that you have. And that isn't the way we spend our time, for goodness sake. All of these speakers
to answer the questions, but that doesn't seem to. I mean, a lot of the folks we did talk with did have a lot of questions for us that were reasoned. We had some wonderful discussions again back and forth, but again, there were a lot of discussions that were pretty heated and just getting pelted by the steamrollers that just had all kinds of objections.
Sure,
I had one that I was. If you have time, I'd want to throw at you just for, because I didn't do a good job at answering it, and
all
it kind of caused me to stumble a little bit. But in general, our students were so great, we could just handle almost any of the objections if they would let us. and give us an opportunity to share and not just go on to another topic or such. And that's where it was nicer to have a one-on-one conversation.
Well, you have sure, and those are going to be a lot more productive. By the way, you did pique my curiosity on this, and I want to ask you about that in a second. But here's a question you just put in your back pocket and that I'd want to refine just a little bit to get it just so. But what I'm looking for from them is your commitment to reason. Because of your commitment for reason, and again, I'm working on the exact wording, but I'm trying to figure out exactly what is the conflict between a commitment to reason and a belief in God. So I believe in reason, therefore for these rational reasons, I cannot believe in a God. My argument against God, based on my commitment reason, is this. What is it? You do not believe in God because – finish the sentence – I'm just curious. I'm not even going to argue with them. I just want to know what is their evidence. My evidence against God based on reason is. I mean, I've had people say, you know, it's irrational to believe in God. And I said, okay, based on the dictates of rationality, what's the conflict? What about believing in God is irrational? And, I'm just interested in the answer to that question. In any event, what was the question that was asked of you?
One of the ones that I had a little bit difficulty with when they're looking at Scripture, and especially, dismissing all of Christianity or Christian teachings because not all Christians, even evangelical Christians, agree upon certain teachings. And, of course, there's, what commandments and what teachings are we obligated to follow? And since we don't do that very consistently, and the ones Old Testament to New Testament you can kind of deal with fairly easily. When you're talking about New Testament teachings focused alone, it was brought up about head coverings and whether women should wear head coverings.
Okay, all right, I got that. Let me give you a response. I'm not going to respond to the question proper because I think that this is a misplaced challenge. So I want to explain to you why I think it's a misplaced challenge. I got to go to break. How is it? Now I'm just role playing this now. Yes, there are differences of opinion. How is it that there are differences of opinion about what passages mean, or differences of opinion about how passages are applied? How is that an argument against the foundational principles of classical Christianity or even in theism? There are atheists who are moral objectivists and atheists who are moral relativists. By the way, that's a big deal, by the way, whether morality exists or not. Those who believe in objective morality ground it in an appeal to evolution, Darwinian evolution. Some ground it in an appeal to kind of a social contract. Some say that these are objective features of the furniture of the world and they don't have any explanation whatsoever. These are different ways that atheists have talked about these issues. Some of them believe in multiverse, some don't. Do the variations in these ideas among atheists somehow represent a reason to reject atheism as false because atheists disagree with each other about the details? The point I'm making is that this objection doesn't make any sense to me because it doesn't go to the heart of the issue. You Christians can't even agree among yourselves. All right, so what? Well, I'm not sure what that means. How that bears on the question of whether or not some version of Christianity is true or whether God exists or not, just because we can't agree.
Where this came from primarily are those that are really trying to support gays and gay marriage and gay rights.
Uh-huh.
And such of that nature. And so they want to go ahead and dismiss any teachings that would be biblically anti-gay. One of the reasons that they're going that route.
Okay,
but then they just want to dismiss Scripture as objective.
Well, but that's because they don't like the conclusions.
Exactly.
But that is not an argument for their view. I don't like this, therefore it's not true. That Bible teaches against homosexuality. I believe in homosexuality. therefore it's not true. Well, that might be a good reason for them not to believe it if they're already committed to a point of view that is inconsistent with the Bible. That explains why they don't believe in the Bible, but that is not a rational defense for their view.
We didn't really hear.
Do you know what I'm saying?
We didn't hear a rational defense for their view.
No, it's just it's
really
a non sequitur. I don't believe anything that Tony in Hickory, North Carolina, has to say. Why not? Because I disagree with his views. Therefore, I don't believe him. Well, that explains why you don't believe him, but it doesn't explain why he's wrong in his views and why you're right. It's just a pass. It's another circular reasoning. And once again, it's an example, I think, of the atheist not using reason regarding his view, but simply using emotion in this particular case, assuming his point of view and dismissing those that disagree. Tony, thank you for your call. I'm glad you're out there on the field. Got to go to break. Back in a moment. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad. Available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Are homosexuals going to hell? Find out the answer by downloading my latest podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann, from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Kokel back with you here in our final segment of our first hour at Stand to Reason. Let me jump right to the calls. In Seattle, we have Sasky. Did I say that right, Sasky? Sasky in Seattle. Line one. Hold on just a minute. We're trying to find you. I pushed the button. Do we have his volume up? Yes, we do. Sasky. Well, I did the right thing here. Let me just put you on hold, Sasky, and I'm going to go to Isaac, and I apologize for the mix-up here, so we'll try to figure out what's going on. Let's see if Isaac in Gardena, California. Isaac, you there?
Hello.
Hello. There I see. I hear Isaac. We'll have to find Sasky and figure out what's going on. What's up, Isaac?
Well, welcome back, Uncle Greg.
Thank you so much. I had a nice time. I got a little sunburn, but I'll survive.
Hey, it didn't show up on the Facebook pictures. Just looked like you guys were having a blast.
Yeah, we were. The sunburn's on my back, so I didn't take a photo of that. It was when I was swimming around with a snorkel, you know, or something. Annie, what's on your mind today?
My question is, when is it ever appropriate to pull life support from another human being, mm-hmm. coming from a Christian perspective?
Yes.
And I guess, I was just talking about this with my brother and a friend, and it was just kind of put out there. Well, what if there's no measurable brain function, you know? And you know that happens. I mean, obviously, I agree with the statement that if there is actually no brain function, then, you know, if the person's brain dead, then they're actually dead.
That's right.
But I mean, as far as, you know, the medical equipment, if they're not able to measure any brain function, then, you know, and they need the life support, otherwise, you know, no part of them would be alive. You know, I guess some people were thinking that made a difference in the distinction.
Okay, let me give you a guideline here that I think will be helpful. Actually, I'm going to give you a couple of them. And that is, the first one is, whatever decision that one makes, it has to be made treating the human being as an individual with intrinsic value. All right?
Right.
Okay, so this is, you asked about the Christian worldview, and which I think is the view of reality, is the appropriate view of reality. I think human beings are special. They are different simply in virtue of being human. This is why we call them human rights and not person rights. I should say this is why we've classically called them human rights and not person rights, because humans are not valuable because they gain some capability that gives them value, which capability, if they lose, then they lose value. Rather, human beings have intrinsic value. That means the value obtains to coheres to them, if you will, or applies to them, or is theirs simply in virtue of being a human. Human beings are valuable. All human beings, from the beginning of being a human until the end of being a human, which means from the beginning of their human existence to the end of their human existence, and I'm talking largely biologically now. So that's the first thing that has to be in place. Here's a second principle that I think it's good to write down, and that principle is, if it is morally acceptable to withhold the treatment to begin with, it is morally acceptable to withdraw the treatment. If it's morally acceptable to withhold it, then it's morally acceptable to withdraw it. And I think you just have to reflect on that for a moment to see the sensibility there. If I'm not obliged to give X treatment under this set of circumstances to begin with, but I do give it, and the person or the heart, whatever, the person still hooked up, however you want to characterize it, if I'm not obliged to give it to begin with, then I'm not stuck once I give it and I can never withdraw it. Like, oh my gosh, I wish I hadn't plugged him in to begin with, because now I can't pull the plug. If you weren't obliged to give it, you're not obliged to sustain it. So the real question that we have to ask ourselves is, what is our obligation to give treatment? And if we can answer that question, then it answers the question for us when we're obliged to give it and when we're free to remove it. Okay?
Yes, you piqued my interest with this last one, because I would not intuitively think that there is a situation where we don't have the obligation, or we do. So I'm listening.
Well, one easy case is, I think, because individual human beings have certain autonomy over their own bodies, there's a general principle that the individual gets to refuse treatment if they choose.
True.
If they say, look, I don't want this, therefore don't give it to me. If the person has, because they are valuable human beings made in the image of God, because they have those kinds of rights in virtue of being human, one of them is a certain right to autonomy. And I think we need to honor, morally speaking, we're obliged to honor their request. So if they have a DNR, do not resuscitate, that's their choice, leave them alone. They go into code and you let them pass on. They have assessed their own circumstance. They want to refuse the medication, that's up to them. So that's one element. Secondly, what about if we don't know what their wishes are? And so what obligation do we have to give help? And there are two principles here that I'll go over quickly. I've just got a couple of minutes here at the end of the hour, so, but at least I can get them out to you. And here's the first, The first principle, and the first principle is that you have a. Let's go a little bit longer. The extra 2 minutes. That there's a reasonable expectation of benefit. That there's a reasonable expectation of benefit. That the treatment has to do some good. Now, I don't mean benefit in terms of quality of life. I mean benefit in terms of really making a difference with this particular issue. There's got to be reasonable expectation of benefit. There's a fudge word there, reasonable. It's a judgment call, but that's one thing that's in place. Secondly, is it has to you have to be able to do it without placing an undue burden on the patient. An undue burden on the patient.
You mean like pain?
Pain isn't the issue in undue burden. It's a broader question I can't go into a lot of detail on right now. But there are palliative measures available to us, that is pain-reducing measures that are available to us that we can use so that pain shouldn't be the biggest factor. But I do not think we can act in a way to take someone's life who's still alive just simply because they're in pain. We cannot kill a person because they're in pain. That is treating
right.
The person as a means to an end and not an end in themselves. We can't kill them. If they're not dying, we can't kill them. And this is something where, like, people say, well, we can unplug. Wait a minute. A lot of these people, if you unplug them, they're going to still stay alive. If they're still alive, you can't kill them. But if the aid you're giving to them – look, if you're giving them insulin to keep alive, there's a reasonable expectation of benefit there, and there's no burden. There's not an undue burden on them. All right? And by the way, I make a distinction between medical treatment and care. Food, water, air, these are the kinds of things. These are not medical treatments. If you withhold food, water, or air from any human being, that human being, and you let nature take its course, that human being's going to die. So we always have an obligation to give care.
Right, like the Terry Schiavo.
Yeah, there is some debate as to whether feeding tubes are considered medical treatment or just appropriate feeding. That's a different case, but you're right. That's in question. That's a toss-up. You know, that's a place where there's discussion about that. But I'm just going to leave you with these two notions, that there's an assessment that has to be made whether the medical treatment characterized that I did, not food or water or air, if the medical treatment creates an undue burden on the patient, not on other people, and whether there's a reasonable expectation for the patient's condition. Look, if a patient is dying of cancer, all right, and it's terminal, and they code, they have a full arrest that's unrelated to the cancer, bringing this person back through CPR or something only to die of the cancer would be an example in my way of thinking of no reasonable expectation of benefit for the person. Anyway, those are the principles that ethicists use that take seriously the value of the individual that have to make these decisions. Thank you, Isaac, for the question. We've got 2 hours ahead. And into hour number two, I'll be talking a little bit about the cruise I returned from. Stay with us here on Stand to Reason. Friends, Greg Kochel, Stand to Reason, and glad to be back with you this week, having just returned last evening from my Stand to Reason Caribbean cruise. Stand to Reason Caribbean is the way Eva, my 4-year-old, characterized it. All last week with a great group of people. Missed you last Sunday because I was on the high seas in the Caribbean. In fact, Sunday, where were we? It's a whole day of sailing on our way from Fort Lauderdale to Grand Turk, which was our first stop. Glad, as I mentioned, to have you with me, and all our American Family Radio networks joined us this hour here. And please get the podcast last hour, I talked a little bit about the Reason Rally in Washington, D.C., and some of my reflections on the atheists' commitment to reason. And you can get that on our podcast at iTunes or str.org. And next hour, I will have Tom Gilson with me talking about a book that he helped put together called True Reason. And it's a book in response to the Reason Rally types. And that, and he was actually at the rally yesterday, so we'll be talking more about that. Then this hour, I want to devote to your calls, 1-800-227-5278. I should say largely to your calls. I do have some opening comments about the cruise. But Roman on the lines here, and be glad to take your call. There, 1-800-227-5278 if you're in the 714 area code. 754-4150 is the direct line. I mentioned that I was gone on the cruise last week, and boy, it was really great. To me, the greatest thing about cruises are the people I get to interact with. We did go to a lot of good ports. We went to Grand Turk, I mentioned a few moments ago. We went to San Juan, Puerto Rico. We went to St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands. We went to Half Moon Cay, which is kind of a private island leased out by Holland Lines that we cruise with. And, you know, a lot of swimming and snorkeling and getting sunburn and whatever. So that's always great. And it was warm and sunny every day, except for one day it rained a little bit in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Was it San Juan? No, it was St. Thomas. And my wife was shopping, and I decided to run back to the boat. So I took a jog about 2 miles back to where the ship was at and got rained on. But it reminded me of living in Maui or in Hawaii when I did. You know, get this hot weather, humid, and it rains on you. So what? Or living in Thailand, you're always wet anyway from sweat. It was fine. The beaches were crystal clear water. It was great. Also, one of the things I really enjoyed about this particular cruise is that it was a totally a Standard Reason staffed cruise. We didn't have outside speakers, which were fine in the past, but we thought this time let's just have Brett Kunkel and Alan Schliemann as the other speakers, and Derek White was there handling the product and the taping and the like, and we just. I just had a great time, not only with the fellas there, my young guns speakers who did a fabulous job, but it was nice having all their families there. And we had lots of kids. We had the Schliemann's kids. We had the Kunkels. We had the Kokels. We had the Whites there. We had two infants. We had 3 4-year-olds. We had 2 7-year-olds. Actually, one of the 4-year-olds turned 5 on the cruise, the Schliemann's daughter, Sarah, and in addition to 2 7-year-olds, we had a 9, a 10, and a 15. And it was great to have the 15-year-old, Lexi, Brett Kunkel's wonderful daughter, who just had – she was kind of like a babysitter, you know. But she enjoyed it and swam with the kids in the pool and on the beach, and it was really, really great to have all those kids together who hung out with each other. They knew each other, but we don't get together as often. So that was great. But I'll tell you what the best part of the cruise was for me. The best part were the people who came along, and this is the case every single time we have a cruise. This is the fourth Standard Reason cruise and my fifth cruise. I was out as a speaker for another cruise and brought my family with, but it was especially satisfying Standard Reason cruises because they're largely Standard Reason people. We had people from all over, 3 couples from Canada. We had 2 from Australia. Viv and Kate, believe it or not, came all the way from down under. We had some who were not committed followers of Christ, which was fine. Glad to have them there. And I think we left a stone in their shoe, or maybe in some cases a boulder. We certainly gave them something to think about, and we were glad to have them as part of our group. We had one couple, by the way, that one of the Canadian couples, Chris and Kelly. Chris actually found out about Stand to Reason, and we have these breakfasts, so every morning 7 people can join me for breakfast, and I get to know in a more personal way. And one of the biggest questions I ask, or the first questions at least, is how did you come to know about Stand to Reason? And Chris shared with me that he had actually, as a Canadian, watched, 8-10 years ago, the TV show Test of Faith with Valerie Pringle, which is a show that I talk about. I share my experience there in a couple of different talks. It was a very interesting TV challenge that I faced for an hour on national cable TV, this program Test of Faith, and Chris actually watched that. He was, I think, a marginal Christian is the way he characterized himself, slipping away a little bit. And when he saw the TV show where I was being challenged by a bunch of liberal religious types who thought that I was narrow-minded, arrogant, and intolerant because I didn't believe in religious pluralism, that all religions led to God, he watched that, and God used that as, according to his testimony, a pivotal point in his life to set him on a new trajectory, which changed everything for him. And here he was now on the cruise, having benefited for years now. That was about 8 years ago, maybe 10. Benefiting for years now from Stand to Reason and our other, you know, friends out there who are colleagues of ours and who have their own enterprises, but maybe he was introduced to by STR. And has now solidified in his faith, got married a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. His wife is on board with him, Kelly, and they're leading a youth group now and investing those people with Stand to Reason ideas. And, gee, you never know. There I was in Toronto getting beaten up by the Sikh and the Hindu pastor and this liberal Christian pastor from the United Church of Canada. I say beaten up because that was their hostile attitude. And I don't mean just intellectually hostile. They were bugged at me. I didn't feel like I was being beaten up. It was a wonderful grace of God that settled on me in that particular thing. And I was able to comport myself with a measure of grace. And this had an impact on at least one person to change their life. And it reminded me that you just never know who's watching. You never know who's listening. You never know who's eavesdropping in to a conversation you're having with somebody and kind of a ricochet evangelism kind of thing. You just never know. You never know what small thing or large thing, as the case may be, is going to make the difference in an individual's life. And I've got a lot of examples that I could give you of small things that people did that made a big difference in my life, or small things I did that apparently made a difference in other people's lives. It isn't just a TV show. It happened to be in this case. But those aren't the only kinds of things that God uses. I'm on TV sometimes. You may never be on TV. Doesn't mean you can't make a difference. You never know. In fact, one of the most significant things that ever happened in my life, I can't give you detail now, I don't have time. I have talked about this in the past, was meeting a Christian maybe 3 or 4 months before I became a follower of Christ and on a bus. And that encounter changed deeply influenced the trajectory that I was to take once I became a Christian. Her name was Adrienne Thatcher. I had never have seen her since that day. But what she offered me by way of witness about Christ made all the difference. Some other time I'll tell you the whole story. I don't even know where Adrienne Thatcher is. Maybe she's listening right now. It happened in Southern California. In any event, it's the small things that can make a big difference. And here it was, this one encounter. Turned on the TV, there I was, and that changed everything for Chris. One of the things that I really appreciated, though, about having a group like that on our cruise, and we had about 60 people plus our staff, so it was a little over 80. When I say staff and families, but 60 conferees, is we have a group there that is already deeply influenced towards thoughtful Christianity. If I'm invited to go speak at a church, and I go to the church and speak, those people showed up most of the time for the church service, not for me. And the pastor or the staff hired me to come and talk to them, and so some of them are glad I'm there, and some of them don't care. But when you have a conference, for example, like an apologetics conference, everybody is choosing to go to that thing because they're deeply interested. So you have a different level of motivation, and that's what we had here on the cruise. Those people came because they cared about what Stand to Reason has offered. And it was great talking to a highly motivated group that were already conversant more or less in the kinds of issues we deal with. And these folks were willing to learn. They were eager to make a difference in the third column. And I, for one, and I know that Alan and Brett, our other speakers, felt the same way. We all counted it as a privilege to be able to provide what we could to them, to offer what we could, to encourage them, to train them, to teach them, to give them to make a contribution in their life as members of the third column. The people out there with their boots on the ground that are engaging one-on-one in their communities and their local churches. So it was once again a fabulous cruise. If you didn't get to go, sorry about that. You missed a great cruise. But we have no immediate plans for cruises in the future, but we've done four so far, and so the chances are fairly good that we'll have another one. Please keep your eyes open. By the way, one of our Canadian couples had been planning for over a year to be on the cruise, and they were there, even though, in the meantime, the wife got pregnant, had a baby about, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks ago, something like that. But still, they wanted so badly to be part of the cruise that they pressed Grandma and Grandpa into service to take care of the child for a week. And now I know this was harder on Mom than it probably was on Dad to leave the baby, but they both were able to be part of our cruise, and we're glad to have them there. All right, let's get to your calls. And now, do we have – let's try again for Sasky. Is this you, Sasky?
Yep, I am so sorry. I had my phone muted last time.
Oh, my goodness. So it wasn't our fault. See, we always think that we did something wrong, and we're looking around trying to figure it out. But I'm glad you stayed with us, Sasky, in Seattle. All right. Nice.
Yep, that's right. Nice to talk to you again, man.
Okay, good. What's on your mind today?
Okay, so if I sound lost, it's because I am. I've just this is something that I've been really trying to get a grip on.
You mean lost spiritually or just facing a difficult challenge?
Lots on this issue that I'm trying to understand.
All
how
right.
to act.
Okay.
If you could maybe have a little public counseling session with me.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what I'm trying to get a feel for.
Glad to have the counseling session with you, but Sasky, you're going to have a hard time staying anonymous because Sasky from Seattle. I don't imagine there's too many Saskys in Seattle.
That's okay.
All right.
I don't mind. That's fine. Basically, looking for some wisdom, I guess. If your spouse or your fiance or girlfriend or whatever is, obviously I'm talking about myself here, is having, maybe there's a conflict that they're having with another person that mm-hmm. you don't have a problem with this third person, but the problem that these two are having isn't necessarily like a sin issue, like one of the other person isn't sinning against
uh-huh.
each other, but there's like a, maybe something happened in the workplace that upset one or the other, and then somehow, you know, naturally you'll get involved in this somehow.
Yeah.
I guess I don't really understand, as a Christian man, what my
obligation is.
I don't know if that's a good starting point. Like,
mm-hmm.
how do you deal with those kind of situations?
Well, I'd say, I don't know the details, obviously, but the first
sure.
thing that comes to mind is I think you have an obligation and a duty to protect your wife and to come alongside her and to be an advocate for her in some sense. Now, what I'm not saying is that you have to always agree with your wife your involvement has got to be informed by the fact that you are her husband and her friend and her protector. All right? And so whatever it is that you end up doing in this, whatever counsel or whatever you give her, is, and I don't know any other way to say it, it simply has to be informed by that. You don't want her to feel like she's on her own, that she's been abandoned, that you're just some person out there that's throwing in a contrary point of view. But rather that even if you may not necessarily side with her on the merits, you still are providing a protective environment for her. Do you have any – are you married, Sasky?
No, I'm not married.
Okay.
I was going to say I'm not married. However, I am dating someone who I
– Sure. Okay. It's a, well, then that factor is diminished somewhat,
yeah,
but not entirely, because my view is that when you are in a personal, intimate relationship of the sort that you're in that, you know, of course, these are the kind of relationships, at least in principle, could go towards marriage, that there's a certain acting out of the appropriate responsibilities in a relationship, even
right,
early on before you're married. So, you know, you're looking for a woman that, though she is not to submit to you in a biblical sense,
mm-hmm,
if you're not married, you still would like to see the tendency that she has of respecting your leadership.
Absolutely,
and,
right.
And by the same token, since your
right,
obligation as a husband would be to love and protect and to guard, as Christ loved the church, etc., Ephesians 5, then these, mm-hmm, these patterns ought to be in play in some sense as you're deepening in your relationship. So I think that that ought to inform it. I was going to make the parallel of children, which you don't have, so it won't mean the same. But, I mean, parents are obliged to guard and protect their children, to be advocates for their children, but it doesn't mean that they defend them in everything, but that in when they address some issue, like if they're in trouble at school or they have a fight or something like that, that they are addressing it as a parent with this protective relationship in place. So there's a difference between how you posture in your relationship and responding to the merits of the issue, whatever it is. I think if say my wife was involved in some dispute and I think she was mistaken about it,
mm-hmm,
then I think it would be appropriate for me to explain to her why I thought that her, you know, maybe she was in the wrong or maybe she wasn't approaching this in the right way, but mm-hmm, I would want to do that from the context or perspective of being the protective husband. Now, of course, sometimes people are, if they're feeling opposed in a relationship like that, they might say, so you're taking their side?
Yes, yeah.
Well, absolutely. I actually think that's an unfair challenge.
Yeah.
Because why should we be expected to take the side of our spouse,
right,
simply because they're our spouse? It could be that the spouse is mistaken. And for the spouse to expect that you kind of take the side entirely of them, I think that's an unreasonable expectation. It's not even good.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you wouldn't, if your kid's a bully, for goodness sake, you're not going to, every time they get in a scrape with somebody in the playground, you're not going to take the kid's side. You're still going to be the dad. But part
mm-hmm,
of being the dad is a protective element, but at the same time holding your child responsible for maybe things that they're doing that are wrong. And by the same token, I think that sometimes those things come up with wives or whatever. So that's, you've asked a general question. I've given a general response.
No, that's what I need right now is the general response, because I'm so like confused on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even really have like a foundation mm-hmm, for that. So
I mean, sometimes you know you just stand aside and you uh-huh, you don't stick your nose in. It depends on the issue.
I was actually going to ask you that. Yeah.
There's a wisdom about this. You know, there's a curious proverb that says, like a man who grabs a dog by the ears is a fool who meddles in trouble that are not his own, or something along that line. Now, I remember it because the picture's so vivid. You grab a dog by the ears. You got a dog looking at you, grab him by the ears. Now, what's that dog going to do?
Poison your little hand.
He's going to bite either your left wrist or your right wrist. You know, let go of my ears. You know, and you're vulnerable. You're right in there. And so it's a good picture. Sometimes you just start meddling and, you know, how does that saying go? That something, the better part of discretion. What is that? Discretion is the better part of valor. Valor,
yeah.
You know, sometimes, just standing aside is a smart thing to do. By the way, does this involve a member of her own family?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, because the rules change a little bit.
Would you say there's a clause for that?
No, I'm just saying that the rules change a little bit. You know, the basic rule is generally when it comes to family that family members can fight against themselves, but if you take up with even your spouse against your family member, sometimes then they turn on you. You know, so that's something then they defend their own family. So you got to be careful of that.
Yeah, I think I may have had that happen once or twice.
So I mean, it's just, this is another dynamic. that yeah, if it's a family member, you got to even tread more carefully because there could be a defensive posture, you know. Yeah. They can beat up on – the wife can beat up on her mother and complain, but then if you complain about your mother-in-law, then it may be that she gets defensive of the mother-in-law. So you just have to be aware of that. And I know there's a lot of married guys that are laughing right now, just like you're laughing, because they're going, oh, man, have I been bit by that one. It doesn't always happen. But and hopefully in a the best of marriages there's a certain kind of there's not that problem, but the spouses can agree that maybe the in-laws are out of line or whatever that kind of thing. But it's just something to be alert for. Does that help, Saski?
Yes. Do you have time for a sub question in that, or
give me a sub real quickly here.
So then I guess practically, is that just more communicating that hey, I'm for you, or hey. Preempting it before you give your critique, I guess, the situation or whatever? Is that...
Well, you might say that. You might say, look at honey, I'm not... You know, I don't want you to take this as... I want you... I'm uncomfortable responding in this particular... I'm still role-playing. I'm uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't even know how to say this, but I want you to know that I'm your friend and on your side, but I'm not sure I agree with the point that you're advancing here. And are you interested in hearing what I have to say? Or whatever, you know, and so you kind of gingerly step into it, your hat in your hand kind of thing. That would be the way to do it. If you thought that the issue was of the magnitude that justified you sticking your nose in.
Okay.
Honey, would you like my opinion on this? I have some observations that might be helpful, but and see what she says. Now, if she says, I'd like your opinion, then you could say, by the way, it may not agree with the position that you're taking here. I got some maybe contrary thoughts. Is that okay? So it's better if you walk into it that way by asking permission than just by sticking your two cents in and then maybe creating a problem. Some people are not open to that, and you need to be aware of it. And then if they're not open, then you have to ask, is the issue of enough gravity that I should go forward anyway? Even though they don't want to hear it, and it may be of that gravity, but most of the times it's not.
Excellent. You think that honestly, world of difference between before and after this conversation. I really appreciate that. Are you ever coming back?
I can hear the relief in your voice. So I.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm talking about because I don't know the specifics, but
that's okay.
Glad to sound.
Honestly, you answered it like that. I really feel like I understand it a lot better.
Okay, great. All right.
Really
all right. Good, Saski. Call me in a couple months and let me know how things are going. All right. Appreciate the call. Yeah.
Of course. Talk to you later.
All the best. Let's go to Annapolis. Do we have to go to break here? Yeah, we should. And then we'll come to Annapolis, Maryland, and Spencer. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. How can we give students confidence that our Bibles have not been changed over time? Find out on this month's Bulletproof podcast. You can download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. One of our tweeples that is on Twitter, or peoples on our Twitter, suggested Reason Radio. I like that. By the way, our homework for this week is actually appropriate given the Reason Rally yesterday and the comments I made earlier. Christianity bolted to reality. That's the commentary that I offer. You can huff and puff, but you can't blow this house down, is the way it reads here. Christianity is a system bolted down to reality. And this, I think, is one of the best ways of approaching from a reasonable perspective why we are justified in saying that Christianity is true. You can find it at str.org. It's your homework for this week. Our featured article, Christianity Bolted to Reality. All right, let's go to Spencer, as I mentioned last segment, in Annapolis, Maryland. Hello, Spencer, you were at the Reason Rally as well yesterday in D.C.
I was there with True Reason, distributing the pamphlets of the first chapter of the book True Reason.
Oh, that's what we'll be talking about next hour. Good.
Yes. But anyways, while I was there, I actually met a bunch of atheists who were willing to have rational debate. It was a really good time. We had some good discussion.
Uh-huh.
But I had a question for one atheist that I was talking to. Was trying to argue to me that Scripture is full of contradictions.
Okay, hold that thought for just a minute. I want to get to this, but I have another question I want to ask you before you get to it. It has to do with your conversations.
Okay.
Did you find yourself principally in the defensive posture where the atheists kept raising a bunch of objections and you were answering them, or were you able to at least ask them for anything like the positive case that these people deeply dedicated to reason were willing to offer for their rejection of God and any religious view?
I'd say for the most part, that I did not hear any positive arguments for atheism.
Uh-huh.
I heard them tell me why they thought the arguments for God's existence didn't work,
mm-hmm.
but I did not hear any positive arguments for atheism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, at least there's, you know, in some cases there's a response to the straightforward arguments for our view. That's encouraging. But okay, go ahead. So they were concerned about the contradictions or what they fancied to be contradictions that were in the Bible, and they gave you an example of one apparently that you had a hard time dealing with. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, let's take a look.
So he was referring to the passage in Matthew 27:52, where it's just after Jesus has died, and it says that the temple veil split in two, and the tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had gone to their rest were raised,
mm-hmm.
and they came out of the tombs after his resurrection, entered the holy city, and appeared to many.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the claim this guy was saying was Matthew is the only gospel that references that event.
Okay.
He called it a zombie apocalypse. He said if there really was a zombie apocalypse, the Romans would have recorded it, and the other gospels would have recorded it. Therefore, Matthew was clearly lying, and Scripture is not infallible.
Okay, I'm just taking a deep breath here because, as is often the case, I find myself willing to engage the alleged contradiction, then being deeply dissatisfied or disappointed with the thing that's offered. And that's what I think about this. First of all, there is no contradiction.
I guess I can tell you what I did answer, but...
All right, if you want to do that.
or I guess my answer at the time was, I said, well, even if I assume you're correct and Matthew was lying about that particular event, that doesn't do. I said that doesn't disprove all the other evidence we have that the resurrection of Jesus did
sure.
take place.
Okay, that's good. And you kind of, in a certain sense, changed the topic, which is all right. If you're simply okay. saying, even if you go forward and you're true about this, it doesn't affect the main case I'm advancing for Christianity. And by the way, that is a very important strategic point. Our case for Christianity, or at least the kind that I offer, advance in the people that are like me, is not that the Bible is inerrant in everything that it's written, and therefore you should believe it. By the way, I do believe it's inerrant, but what I said was, so people don't misunderstand me, as I said, the case that I offer is not that it's inerrant. The case I offer to people like the ones that you encountered is that it's historically reliable.
Right.
No historian makes a demand on a text that purports to give history that it be inerrant in everything that it speaks to.
Right.
No historian requires that. So our case is based on the historical reliability of the salient details of the Gospels. This we can defend, and if that's true, then one of the things that we have good reason to believe took place was the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, and therefore we can make our case for Christianity based on that. Whether or not Matthew was accurate on this verse is irrelevant to the case we're making. Now, it does
right.
bear on the question of inerrancy, and
right.
so what all he has proven, if he's proven anything, is that the Bible's not inerrant. But that's not part of our case. So he has refuted an argument that we haven't advanced.
Right.
And this kind of thing happens all the time, and I think it's good that you are disciplined to point out that this is irrelevant to the case that you're making. But let's just
right.
look at the issue proper and see what we can make of this. So he says,
if he had forced me to go into it, I don't feel I would have had a good answer. So
all right, but you don't need. How can I put this? His challenge is a weak challenge, and all you need to show is that it's a weak challenge, not that you have
right.
a good answer in a certain sense to the passage itself. So my first observation,
okay.
since Melinda wrote here Bible contradiction, and I don't know if that was what he said to you, but if he's saying the Bible is contradictory, here's an example, and then he cites okay. to you a passage that has no other parallel in the Gospels, it immediately occurred to me, as you're explaining this, I don't even know what it is, but you said there's something that happens in Matthew only. Well, then it can't be a contradiction. A contradiction is where you have a statement in one gospel that is contradictory to a statement in another gospel. And by the way, a contradiction is a very specific kind of thing. But if you only have one reference, then it can't be a contradiction. It might be false, but
yes.
it doesn't fail in virtue of contradiction. So
yeah.
the first thing I'd say to him is, well, this isn't a contradiction. I mean, you're
right.
just labeling it wrong. What you have
right.
is you have a singular reference regarding some
right.
event that Matthew alleges took place. All right. So
all right.
just because there's a singular reference, you can't presume that it's not accurate. There are all kinds of singular references in bona fide historical accounts. No historian requires that an account have corroboration for every sentence that it records.
Right.
I mean, the history would be impossible. What you do is you look at the broader account and you ask yourselves whether the account itself is credible by other measures. And the credibility of the larger account then flows to the credibility of the individual statements that are not corroborated by other accounts. That's kind of the way
right.
it works. Now, it might be that the statement is unbelievable on its face. Well,
right.
and that might be what your friend is stating, but
his major argument is he said if it did happen, then the Romans would have recorded it. Like he said, if there was a zombie apocalypse, we would have like a Roman record of that happening.
But the Romans didn't record hardly anything. When you look at the things at the things that were recorded by Roman historians versus the things that took place, we've got nothing. The amount of history of details that were recorded, they're virtually non-existent. There's the most – look, we do have Roman historians that weighed in on a couple of things. But there are gazillions of things that never took place. What he's doing is he's importing a 20th century, now 21st century kind of mentality back into a first century. If there were zombies walking around, boy, CNN, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, Fox News would be all over it.
Right.
They didn't have that kind of thing then. That kind of reporting wasn't done. In principle, there could have been all kinds of things that took place that they never recorded because there wasn't the means to record those kinds of things, and things that were recorded largely didn't survive. So he is making an argument that it couldn't have happened because there wasn't this reporting when that kind of reporting wasn't done on the main anyway. So he cannot draw the conclusion he draws from the evidence that he has.
Right.
He is making a demand that is unreasonable given the period of time that he's talking about.
Okay.
It simply doesn't follow that if something like that happened, then they would have reported it. Well, by the way, why doesn't he make that statement about the resurrection?
Okay, well, he did talk about that and when it came to the resurrection, too. And we had in our debate about the resurrection went into a lot. Ended up really devolving into he said, she said sort of thing, because I was saying, historical scholars who all agree that the evidence for the resurrection is true, and his objection was, and he's kind of said, you know, those are all fundamentalists. The vast majority of historians think Jesus was a fictional character.
This is one of those Internet urban legends, you know, the vast majority of historians think that Jesus was a fictional character. This is factually false. Just the facts, ma'am.
That is exactly what I told him.
This is factually false, but it doesn't, you know, the question I think it might be fair to ask a person at this when they say this is what kind of evidence counts? What kind of evidence? How about evidence from a Jewish historian? What about a Roman historian? What about a Greek historian? What about the Jewish Talmud? These don't have these biases, first of all. So why doesn't this count?
I did bring up Josephus in the Jewish Talmud, and he said that his answer essentially was there's controversy over whether or not those accounts were written close enough to the time the events actually took place.
There isn't controversy about Josephus's writing because they know when Josephus wrote, and he wrote between 90 and 100 A.D. and he can give testimony to the facts that were currently to the information that was circulating at the time. Notice what is at stake here is whether Jesus existed, not whether Jesus did the things that he claimed to be, that the Christians claim for him to have done. He testifies to the execution of James, who is the brother of Jesus. He testifies to that. So he makes an historical reference to Jesus there, and he also testifies to Jesus himself. There is an embellished account of that, but we also have documents that don't have the embellishments that seem to be the core testimony of Josephus. Now, look, you can say you don't believe this if you want to, but that is historical evidence from the time, and it has to be taken into consideration. What you can't do is make a conclusion Jesus was a fiction, and every single time you produce some evidence that he wasn't a fiction, have it dismissed. That is not an academically sound way of doing it, and it's not a reasonable way of doing it. There are 17 ancient historical references to Jesus of Nazareth that are not found in any biblical literature. 17. The Talmud identifies Jesus as a sorcerer, and that's why he was put to death. There's a testimony there to his miraculous workings. Now, they testify that it was a devil, you know, a demonic or an occultic source of it, but it was still a testimony to miraculous efforts. So, there are a number of others as well of that. If a person wants to say none of that counts, because they don't like the reference, well, then they're free to say that. But that seems to be self-serving. They are just dismissing anything that could look like evidence in favor of his existence. The fact is, almost nobody in the historical realm says that Jesus is a fiction. Just go to the Encyclopedia Britannica, for goodness sake.
I didn't say the Encyclopedia Britannica, but that's exactly what I told him. I said, I mean, I'm sorry, but you're just plain wrong about that. And he said, well, we're just going to have to disagree. And then we kind of went on to another
Yeah, if you can say, look at the most famous work of history in history is The Story of Civilization by, I'm trying to think of his name. Actually, I got it here somewhere, the primary source. And in this, there's a long discussion about Jesus and, you know, who he was and what he did. And I'm digging around looking for this. I got a thing somewhere here. I'll have to find it later. What's his name? He and his wife, The History of Civilization. What is that, Melinda? Durant, D-U-R-A-N-T. The most famous work of history in history is the 20-volume, I think, History of Civilization by the Durants. And they have a whole volume called Caesar and Christ. A whole volume. Now, is this guy just making all of this up? He concludes that Jesus is one of the most remarkable figures of history. He doesn't agree that everything in the Gospels is true. By the way, it's also a fallacy to disregard the Gospel accounts because they were written by Christians. This is a fallacy called the genetic fallacy.
Yes.
That's like saying, accounts of the Holocaust that you can trust are the ones written by Holocaust deniers, because people who said they were there at the Holocaust obviously are biased.
Yes.
It's just a ridiculous way to argue. You have to judge the documents on their merits, not just assume that because they're written by Christians, then they're – this is another flight of fancy by this so-called reasonable folks at the Skeptic Society. You know, you can't trust anything written by Christians. Why? Well, they have a bias. They have a motive to lie? You know, what is their motive to lie? They're dying for this testimony. What is their motive to lie? Where's the evidence that they actually distorted? So, real historians do not say these kinds of things. By the way But even Bart Ehrman, by the way, you know, in his new book, you know, Bart Ehrman, who's always challenging the reliability of Scripture, says Jesus existed. So even though he'd disagree on some of the details, I mean, this is an academically irresponsible thing to say. And these guys say this all the time as if there is no good academic reason to believe that Jesus existed. I have written a piece of solid ground on this called Jesus Myth Factor Myth or something like that. It's a solid ground from a couple of years ago. Plus, I have a teaching on it, so you can find it at str.org. But anyway, I hope that helps, Spencer.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And might I say, besides this one guy, the conversation wasn't very productive, but I talked to at least 8 different atheists there, and I believe I made good arguments for all the kids, everything I had to say, and that's a lot of that's due to
Well, I'm so glad to hear that, and good for you. I'm glad that you've been a good ambassador there and that we helped out. Okay, all the best to you.
All right, thank you.
All right, we're going to go to Jonathan in Oklahoma in just a minute. Let's go to break first, though, and I'll be back here on Stand to Reason.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Are homosexuals going to hell? Find out the answer by downloading my latest podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann, from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel back with you here. Stand to Reason, and that piece that I wrote was called Jesus Recycled Redeemer a couple years ago, maybe two and a half years ago. You find it at the str.org website under, what is that drop down? Solid Ground Archives, but it's under Resources, I think. Drop down Resources, Solid Ground Archives, Jesus Recycled Redeemer. I want to emphasize before I go to Jonathan in Norman, Oklahoma, I think there's a famous bass fisherman that lives there. Well, I'll find out in just a minute. That we should be surprised to find any detail of ancient history that survives for 2,000 years in any manuscript. When you consider how history or how things were recorded, which was on either papyri, or which is papyrus paper, or vellum, which is a skin of an animal, but both organic, and that people didn't care about news and keeping track of amazing things that happen, we should be surprised to find anything that survives. So to say that something amazing written by Matthew wasn't picked up by the news corps in the first century and broadcast around the world, well, that's not a good reason to believe that it didn't happen. Now, it doesn't prove, obviously, that Matthew's telling the truth, but the rationale was Matthew wrote this, nobody else reported it, therefore he's lying. Incidentally, notice how I took the objection that was offered our last caller at the Reason Rally, and I just reduced it to its simple argument form. Matthew recorded it. No one else reported this amazing thing like no other Romans. Therefore, it didn't happen. Can't you see, once you reduce it to its simple form, that this just doesn't follow? Just because we have no example of reporting of it didn't mean that nobody reported it. I mean, very little survives 2,000 years. And even if they didn't report it, it doesn't mean it didn't happen, because people weren't in the habit of reporting things back then. Oh, my goodness. It's just a poor challenge. Now, it could be that Matthew was lying, or Matthew was making it up, or Matthew, you can't trust it, but not for those reasons. Oh. By the way, the fact that virtually nobody got his 15 minutes of fame 2,000 years ago in that small corner of civilization should make it all the more remarkable that Jesus of Nazareth is mentioned in some form or some detail in 17 ancient sources. Just think about it. 17 ancient sources he's at least mentioned. How can anybody claim that Jesus never existed? What other fictitious character is mentioned with anything like that frequency and dismissed as a fiction? Where is the parallel to that notion? What justifies people just simply dismissing all of these things and saying Jesus never existed? All right. Jonathan in Norman, Oklahoma. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Thank you. I don't know about any bass fishermen. James Garner's from here.
That's a little more impressive, I think, than
well, I'm impressed more by the bass fisherman, but you by actors. So fair enough. I'm just it just stands out. Norman, Oklahoma. I'm trying to think. You know, I think maybe I know who it is. Jimmy
player.
Houston. Jimmy Houston, I think, is from Norman, Oklahoma. Not sure. But anyway, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm glad to have found you. I have accumulated a lot of questions no one's been able to answer over the years, so I'll definitely be calling back. But this one's kind of the before I can ask any of those at later times, I need this fundamental question answered. What is the purpose of man's existence here on Earth? I mean, obviously, he wants us to worship him, which we'll do in heaven forever, but compared to forever, Earth is just such an insignificant, like the 70 years that we're here is so, it's not even a blip. I mean, it's nothing.
All right.
So why?
Okay. Well, there's a couple ways to answer this. One of them is before you can answer what is our purpose for the existence on Earth, one has to ask, how did we get here? I mean, this is something you probably already covered because you sound like a theist or a Christian, but I'm just saying in principle, if you come upon some object, some artifact that is something that has been worked, okay, by an intelligent designer. So here I've got a glass. Yes. Yeah, so what is the purpose of this glass? Well, you have to ask yourself, well, what was the purpose of the one who made it? And then you know what the purpose of the glass is. Sometimes you can infer that by looking at the thing, even if you haven't heard from the manufacturer, you know, well, this looks like the kind of thing you put, you know, if somebody finds a rounded out like gourd or a stone, you say, well, this looks like it was made for grinding meal or something like that. You can look at the design and infer its purpose. And I think to some degree we can do that here. But for the most part, we need the maker to let us know what the purpose is. And it appears that the statement of the confession that the chief purpose of man is to know God and to enjoy him forever, I think that's the way it goes, that this is a fair characterization of what the scripture reveals. God made us to be in fellowship with him. All right.
Right.
Well, of course, you kind of got that, but you're asking, all right, well, the way I put it, by the way, is in friendship. Some people talk about relationship. Okay, fair enough. But then why on earth for this time? Because it's just a little blip. And so apparently, and there's some indications from Scripture about this, we are placed here on earth, and part of the process of earth is to develop certain spiritual virtues that will serve us for eternity, that apart from our existence on earth, we would not be able to have. The writer of Hebrews calls this a better resurrection. Those in chapter 11 who were rescued by faith, others died by faith, and in so doing, going through this thing, would have a better resurrection. Paul tells Timothy somewhere, and you can look this up, I'm a little under the gun for time here, that godliness is a means of great gain, not just for this life, but for the life to come. So there's a hint in there that we are in a process on this earth of facing trial and difficulty. Jesus was brought through to maturity, according to the writer of Hebrews, by the things which he suffered. And in the same way, we are to go through difficulties and suffering to conform us to his image, to make us into different kinds of creatures for eternity than we would have been able to be apart from this 70 that we share on earth. So there's a sense in which, even though this is a little blip, as you said, in the long haul by comparison to eternity, it still functions to do something for us that will affect how we are in eternity, all right?
So you don't think that the Garden of Eden before sin, that you don't think everything was perfect, that there was suffering?
No, I don't think there was suffering there, but the word perfect has to be defined. And the word perfect means that it was just as its maker intended it to be. So you could have a glass that's a perfect glass, but it's a lousy wrench. All right. So you have to look at its intentions. The Garden of Eden, all that was created was good. That is just as God intended it to be at that time. Then there was a problem, and it wasn't good because there was a diminution of goodness. There was a flaw. There was a breaking of what God intended. There was rebellion, and then God is using this for some other greater good. So whether the Garden of Eden was the first plan and now we're in plan B, or whether God always intended to use this fall for something better, that I don't know, I can debate about right now. But I do get indications from the scripture, which is from the maker himself, on my take of things, that there is purpose and value to this life because we are being transformed through the challenges of this life to something that will benefit us for eternity. Another verse, by the way, is 2 Corinthians chapter 4, the last couple verses. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory, is the way Paul puts it there. There are all these indications in the scripture that our life on earth is a life of trial and difficulty, which creates something for eternity that we would not be able to have apart from the challenges of trial and difficulty of this life. God is taking the difficult things and making it for good. Sorry?
So there would have to be, so if that's our purpose, then there would have to be trial and difficulty in the original plan of the Garden of Eden, right? Or
well, you ask, what is the purpose of existence on the earth? And I'm trying to give you some of the rationale the scripture gives for that. How it relates to the original plan, I'm not in a position to answer right now. It was clear that the original plan was good, just the way God intended it. However, there are virtues that cannot be experienced except for in a fallen world. Long-suffering is a virtue, but you can't have long-suffering, you can't experience long-suffering without something to suffer long regarding. So there's just some area of reflection that might be fruitful for you. Thank you for your call, Jonathan in Norman, Oklahoma. And coming up next, Tom Gilson, the author, the editor of, where's my notes? Well, I'll tell you in just a moment. The Reason, or True Reason book, and we'll be talking to him about the Reason Rally in Washington, which he was at yesterday. Stay with us here on Stand to Reason for hour number 3. Our final hour here on Stand to Reason, 2 hours just before us now, our third hour, and I'm going to have a conversation with a friend of mine. Actually, Tom Gilson and I have been acquaintances for, actually, I think a fairly long time. I can't remember the first time we kind of formally met, but the first time we really were, I think, engaged each other, Tom, was at the SES conference in Charlotte last fall. Is that right?
That's right. We bumped into each other there, Charlotte, the year or two before, but that's the first time you and I really got a chance to talk with each other.
Yeah, and you were talking about Oratio Christi there, introducing the concept, which I was really thrilled to hear about and have since written about and commended to people. So, and from what I can tell, Oratio Christi is going strong.
It is one of the most amazing things that I have ever seen. It's something that was just waiting to take off, mm-hmm. and it needed some leadership, like Rick Shanker and Blake Anderson and others to light a match to it, and it is just growing like mad. It's a great thing to see.
And we, as I recall, didn't we have lunch at ETS in November in San Francisco, Rick and you and I and some other Stand to Reason guys?
No, right? I didn't get to make that trip.
That wasn't you. I'm trying to think who
someone
that was.
Else. Yeah.
Well, whatever. Anyway, Mostly I want to talk to you, Tom, a little bit about not only the rally yesterday, which I opened my show having commentary about, just in general. I've actually read a portion of your e-book, True Reason, which you edited along with some others, and a lot of contributors there. I want to talk about that a little bit, too. But you have been, of course, involved in a lot of things in the last few years is with Campus Crusade for Christ, now called CRU, and as a strategist for them, and also Ratio Christi of late. You've been a columnist for Breakpoint, and you're working with Colson and a lot of, in the Worldview Center there, and a blogger at Thinking Christian. So you've done a lot. You've had your a lot of irons in the fire, but you're really, I think, in a well situated to make the contribution that you have with this ebook, True Reason, in response to the kind of thing that we saw exemplified at Washington D.C. yesterday. Tell us a little bit about the. Gee, I keep stopping myself from saying the so-called Reason Rally because it sounds it sounds like I'm taking a shot. So I just won't say that, but I have expressed my doubts based on my own experience dealing with skeptics and atheists, whether right. reason plays a significant role in their rejection of God and rejection of Christianity and belief in atheism. But in any event, let's just leave it at Reason Rally. We won't make judgments on it. And okay. You were actually there, right?
I was there. Yes, it was a bleak day. It was chilly. It was rainy, and it was spiritually bleak. Mm. And it was, yeah. I don't know if you can call a rainy day a dry day, but it was all of those things.
Yeah, there was, from what I understand, 20,000 people there. CNN, I think, reported on that, or maybe it was USA Today, but there were a lot of people there. 20,000, I don't know, that's not big for the mall. I mean, the mall can take millions, I think, but I imagine it looked like a sizable group.
It looked sizable. I actually saw a report that said it was 8,000 to 10,000, and that falls under the category of who do you believe. I'm no judge of the group, but it wasn't an overflow crowd by any means. It was just comfortable.
Well, I'm willing to give them their 20,000. I think the percentages of the population in general have been about 2% atheist or right around there. Hasn't changed much from what I understand, even with the new atheists coming on board and writing and the bestsellers and all that. But I think the ones that are atheists have gotten a lot more aggressive. And that is the I think that if we learn nothing from anything from yesterday, I think that's one thing we've got to take seriously. These folks are kind of on the move.
They are organizing, and they're doing it somewhat effectively, and they're making some noise. They're getting some media attention in a different kind of a way than they were before. Mm-hmm. They are they're getting their message out there. They're saying reason everywhere they go.
Yeah.
It's in the titles of their organizations, the names of their books. It's in I had an electronic copy of Sam Harris's Moral Landscape, and it has the word reason in it on average once a page in different forms.
Mm-hmm.
It's all over everywhere. And so, yeah, that's the brand that they're trying to market.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really glad that our organization is called Stand to Reason, and that Bill Craig is Reasonable Faith, and Hugh Ross is what Reasons to Believe, because we do not want to allow those who disagree with us to be characterized simply with the word reason. I was thinking of a different way of describing it, but you know, to own that word, because I don't think it's fair to apply only to them simply because they're atheists. But that there is kind of a sense as I listen to these guys, Tom, that atheism and reason are almost like, to them, they're almost like synonyms.
Sure.
And that if you don't hold to atheism, you are by their definition an unreasonable person.
Right. And it's I'm looking up here. I've got the definition of reason that Richard Dawkins gave to the Washington Post a couple of days ago is reason and logic and evidence. The only way to know what's true is to look for evidence and then deduce reasonably what follows from the facts as you observe them, or as you get them out of an experiment. That's the only way to know what's true, and I think it's perfectly... Well, he goes on to say that there come a time when everyone accepts that evidence and reason and logic are the way to discover
what is true. It's very empirical. If you press it too far, you'll find that there's a self-contradiction in there, because he's requiring everything to be based on empirical evidence, which I don't know the empirical evidence for his definition.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting what he's offered. I mean, you got to start with definitions. If you're going to say you're reasonable, you got to say, what do you mean by that? You know, this is really, really key. And to say that, well, reason seems to be those things where you're holding a view that is supported by certain evidence or facts, or offering a rationale that justifies your conclusion. Now, my way of putting it is a little different than the way he put it, because I said offering a rationale that justifies your conclusion. He wanted to cash out reason as he kept going, in the sense of empiricism,
right,
and kind of scientific method, which is a bona fide legitimate way of knowing. But with a person like that, I want to ask the question, does he know what he's thinking right now? And
right.
If he does know what he's thinking right now, what is the means by which he knows that? It certainly isn't any scientific investigation or empirical method. And
right.
So you know where I'm going with this.
Sure.
You know, it seems like what he's done is he has been careful to define the word reason in a way that favors his pet views, instead of using a way that is a genuine, appropriate definition of reason.
Right. And the other problem with their claiming the brand of reason is, let's suppose for the sake of argument that their empirical definition of reason were accurate. And I don't say that it is, but for the sake of argument, let's suppose it was. It's still not the whole definition of what makes a person a reasoning person. Another part of it is their ability to sustain an argument from beginning with premises or evidences, working through to a valid conclusion by means of sound inferential processes. And you can be as empirical all day long as you want to be, but if you can't get through an argument without tripping over fallacies, you're not a good reasoning person. This is where they are very weak. In fact, I've been a little cautious about this, but I think the correct word is incompetent in a lot of cases.
Well, you know, it does sound like a strong word, but I think this one can be backed up empirically. And indeed, this is precisely what you've done in the book, True Reason. And I've gone through, I think, four of the chapters so far, and have been very impressed by the quality of material here. Got a number of different authors that have weighed in, and they've weighed in specifically on issues that are brought up frequently by atheists, whether it has to do with the question of reason in general or specific rational challenges that they've made to either theistic belief or to Christian ethics and the like. And why don't you tell us a little bit about this book and what the rationale was for bringing it, putting it in play to begin with?
Sure. It started 3 months ago yesterday was when the idea was first conceived, if you can believe that. And
I can, because I think you contacted me and wanted a chapter overnight, and I just thought I wasn't up to the task, but I appreciated
A few people had to say no, but a few people said yes, and it's a testimony to the power of unity in the body and of community and connectedness and pulling together for a cause, and I'm so grateful for the people on the team. Carson Whitenauer, my co-editor, I won't try to name all the authors, but because there were 13 in total, it was very much a joint effort of people saying this is worth doing and worth doing together, and we've got a deadline and we're going to accomplish it. But the occasion for the book was waking up early in the morning on Christmas Eve day and saying, and I don't know why it was on my mind that morning, but this thought in my mind that the atheist have no business claiming the word reason for their own as if they had a lock on it. And you've already said that we've got a claim on it too.
Yeah.
But not only that, but they've got a they've got a rhetorical claim on it that's not backed up by reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, and that morning I thought, somebody should write a book. I wish there were time. And then it occurred to me I knew some somebodies. I knew some, I had some Facebook friends, and maybe we could do it. I had no hope of putting it in print that quickly, but it got out as an e-book.
Let me just go through some of the authors since I have it on e-book and I can access the authors quickly, and maybe you don't have it right there, but William Lane Craig, Chuck Edwards from Summit. By the way, I was really happy not only to see him included in this. He was there that night, SCS in Charlotte, and I was happy to see him included because he's trafficked in this information for a long time. He's not with Summit anymore, but I think is he with Ratio Christi now?
He's with Ratio Christi.
Yeah. But this is a fabulous treatment of Richard Dawkins' argument in his book, The God Delusion, and has the subtitle here, Long on Rhetoric, Short on Reason. Incidentally, I need to add, I'll get to some of the other authors in a moment, but I said this in the first hour, and I want to underscore this so that you and I are not misunderstood, Tom. Part of the challenge, the point of this book is to show that the challenges that have been offered don't go through. So there is a challenge on the merits of the different arguments here. But I think part of what you do that is really valuable, and this is what my opening comments were about at the first hour, was that the atheists who are claiming to use reason, and they're the ones who are the champions of reason, actually do not consistently use reason, but fairly consistently make either formal mistakes in reasoning, or they give in to informal fallacies rather than advancing their arguments. Now, this, of course, doesn't mean that their conclusions are false. Maybe atheism is true, but it is meant to point out that they are not careful and consistent in using reason, though they claim to.
That's really the point of the book, is it's not... We're not here, as so many other excellent apologetics works have done, to say that they've come up with wrong answers. Our attempt has been to say that they are presenting a wrong self-image, a wrong brand, a wrong identity.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, brand and identity and image are very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
They're symbols. They get to people's hearts around their minds, and they work very well that way. And we're trying to say that hadn't ought to be the way we perceive them, because it's wrong. And then, of course, as you know, you'll walk through the book, I think, we come around to a more positive perspective on a Christian view, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like false advertising when they say, this is the Reason Rally, and I'm looking at one of the articles that I downloaded regarding this, and where Richard Dawkins is encouraging people to ridicule, these are his words, quote, ridicule and show contempt, close quote, for religions. Well, this isn't the voice of reason. It just simply is not the voice of reason to do that. I would, and I know, from what I know of you, you would never, certainly Sandra Reason would never, Bill Craig, Josh McDowell, anybody in what I call the second column, or the first column for that matter, all of the people that are making contributions for iSight, who would ever give this as counsel at one of these conferences, ridicule and contempt. That's what we want you to do.
Heavens no. That's one of the things that you see in, and I saw it at the Reason Rally. You see it in the rhetoric between these people, and we have to guard against it because we can do it, is treating people as if they're not people.
Mm-hmm.
Treating them as groups. It's a stereotyping thing. It's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look at our atheist counterparts, not as atheists, but as people who have atheistic opinions that we can engage with them on. Of course, the title atheist fits if it fits.
Mm-hmm.
But if we lump them into a group and say, well, there's a group of people that are just really mixed up, then you can get impersonal, inhuman,
dismissive.
And that's wrong.
Yes. Yeah. Now, by the way, I'm curious how you respond to this one comment by Dan Merica in the CNN piece. And he says, the idea of thousands of atheists gathering together there drew the ire of religious groups. Now, he does mention the Westboro Baptist Church, and which obviously is very controversial. But, I mean, on balance, do you have the sense that Christians are really mad because atheists get together for a rally?
No.
I don't know where he gets this kind of thing.
I say, have a great day. Enjoy the day. I was interviewed by a documentary crew there, and they said, what are the last things you want? Well, they said something like the question you said, and I said, I hope you have a great day. I hope you reason really well. I hope you encounter reality. I hope you have a wonderful day. What's wrong with that?
Sure. I don't know why any religious groups would be bugged. Because the atheists got together. Now I do know there's a little history with Westboro Baptist, and as I understand it, and I'm going to break in just a minute here, Tom. But as I understand it, that Westboro Baptist was actually invited to this event, and you were specifically told not to show up.
That's right.
Yeah, and I have that. We'll talk about that when we return. I'm talking right now about the Reason Rally. My guest, Tom Gilson, who has been responsible for an incredible feat, putting together I got 312 pages on the way it's at least rendered on my tablet right here, my iPad, a book called True Reason. It's an e-book available at book.truereason.org. Did I get that right, Tom?
That's correct.
$2.99. I mean, that won't even buy you a cup of coffee at Starbucks anymore. So what a tremendous value. And there's lots of great stuff here. I've gone through some of the chapters myself. I'll read some of the titles to you when I return. I'm Greg Kokel. More with Tom Gilson after this message. Stay with us.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800-2-REASON today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800-2-REASON to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. How can we give students confidence that our Bibles have not been changed over time? Find out on this month's Bulletproof Podcast. You can download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Ladies and gentlemen, and for a reason, and that is because we care about careful thinking when it comes to the most important issues you can think about, ethics, values, and religion, all connected, by the way. I'm talking with Tom Gilson right now. He's the editor and contributor to True Reason, an e-book that took only 3 months to get to press, as it were, or e-press, and is available for $2.99 as a download from book.truereason.org. And Tom, let me just take a moment and read some of the chapter titles. Is that all right?
Sure.
You actually open up with the Party of Reason, and then chapter two is The Irony of Atheism. I think I'm trying to remember which one is which here, but one of those I read, and I think you pointed out that the irony of atheism, if I understood it correctly, is that these are the Party of Reason that turns out not to use reason that much. When you examine their particular attacks and how they advance their case, would that be fair?
Yeah. In those two chapters, it comes in there, and Carson in the second chapter talks about the atheist's use of reason really rests on a theistic understanding of reality that they don't recognize.
Right. How do you account for the laws of reason if this is a transcendental argument, if materialism is true? No room for reason in a materialistic universe. Then you have the Dawkins delusion. I think that's Bill Craig's contribution. Then the other critique of Richard Dawkins that I mentioned a few moments ago by Chuck Edwards. Unreason at the head of Project Reason. And then you go into more particulars. You got a chapter dealing with John Loftus, who is a fairly well-known former Christian who has written very aggressively. Maybe we'll talk about him in a minute. The explanatory emptiness of naturalism. By it we see everything else. The explanatory value of Christianity. You have reason in a Christian context. Marriage of faith and reason is a science. Are science and faith at odds here? Are science and Christianity at odds? Do God and science mix? So there's a couple of chapters on that issue. Historical evidence for the Gospels. A chapter on that. The problem of evil and a reasonable Christian response. Then you have Christianity and slavery. I haven't read that one yet. But I know this is kind of an attack on Christian ethics. You've got this stuff in the Bible. Christianity is in favor of slavery. Therefore, right. Christianity is immoral. Therefore, Christianity is false. And so you're treating with that. And then finally, the issue of the genocide of the Canaanites. You cover a lot of ground, which seem to be kind of the standard challenges, dealing with the standard challenges that the atheists are offering now.
Yeah, we do. And the point is, not to try to retread everything that's been said before about these things, but to say that we have a positive answer to the charge that Christianity is unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Take, for example, the last two chapters you mentioned about slavery and genocide.
Mm-hmm.
There are one of the ways that atheists, the new atheists in particular, define reason or reasonability is. Let's treat each other reasonably. Let's not start killing each other over our religions, and let's not do these awful things to each other.
Okay.
And they say that Christianity is unreasonable and it's bad because, for example, it supports slavery and genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a lot of other issues we could have picked up along that line, like sexism, for
mm-hmm.
example, and we didn't have room to include them all. But we, just by way of example, we wanted to show that what you think is true about Christianity and slavery isn't
mm-hmm.
true. And at least, if I may borrow a friend's term, put a stone in their shoe and to say, it should bother you if you have always thought this about Christianity and slavery, now you find out that that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the other things that you have always believed about Christianity, maybe you ought to wonder whether those things are true,
mm-hmm.
too.
Well, you know, this brings up a point about how rationality works, and that is, it seems to me there are three ways for an argument proper to go bad. I guess an argument can go bad if you don't even give an argument, you know. But arguments proper, it can be – the form of it could be bad. The conclusion doesn't follow from the premises. Its premises could be false.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I asked the question, listen, did they get their facts right or not? And this is the complaint here. If they're saying this is – Christianity is this way and the Bible teaches thus and so, and in fact it isn't that way and it doesn't teach thus and so, then they've simply gotten their facts wrong.
Yeah.
Which is a violation of reason to begin with. This is a straw man fallacy. So the other way, though, that an argument can go bad is if the terms are not clear.
So you're, it is an equivocation. So you use a term one way in the premises, and then it turns out to have a different meaning in the conclusion. And you just gave a great example of that. People said, people are saying, well, you should treat people reasonably. If we're people of reason, we should treat people reasonably. And the Bible doesn't treat people reasonably. Look at these examples. Therefore, the Bible's not reasonable. But that definition of reason has nothing to do with the definition that Richard Dawkins gave earlier, where he was talking about experiments and empiricism and everything. That was right. Importing kind of some kind of moral point of view into the equation of reason. Sure. And rationality has nothing to do with morality. It doesn't tell you a thing about morality.
Right, but you will find, and we heard this in the speeches and the loud cheers at the Reason rally yesterday, that Christianity is wrong because Christianity is bad. And that's one of the ways that they attempt to show how wrong Christianity is because, oh, it was mentioned that Christianity is against stem cell research and people are going blind from macular degeneration because we're bad and anti-science and therefore, let's get religion out of the public square
so
and
here's
everything
the,
else.
Right. So here's a question that I have, Tom, and I don't know if you address this with them or not, but as far as this whole atheism and morality project, which is really big for them, and there was the debate last summer, I guess, with Sam Harris and Bill Craig about this whole issue. When the atheist says that Christianity is bad, what do they mean by the word bad?
Well, they mean that atheism doesn't live up to their sense of what is right and good, whatever that may be.
Well, see, but that's the question that I'm asking, that whatever is right and good. When I've listened to atheists attempt to ground morality, they have – Sam Harris is a little – exceptional. He's got a little more creative way of doing it. But when they try to ground morality, they always ground it in evolution. I mean, almost universally, they ground it in some kind of Darwinian model. So then when I ask the question, then what on your model of morality, what does bad actually mean? The only thing that I could think of is that bad means that you're not living consistently with what evolution has dictated you should live according to.
But evolution can't dictate.
Of course not. It can dictate behavior in principle, but it can't dictate what you should or shouldn't do.
Right.
And so it just seems to me their project goes into a dead end because they can't even tell you what bad means.
That's right. But they have it. But if they can't explain it to us, they can sure cheer for each other on it.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is what they're doing. And it's a rhetorical move, and it's actually effective.
And it's being effective. So
yes.
Well,
Okay,
so this is – by the way, you've just touched on something that I think is really at the heart of this. And again, I'm trying to be descriptive here and not just weigh in negatively on these folks because I disagree with their conclusion. But I actually think that these guys are very, very long on rhetoric. And I mean that kind of as a positive in the sense that they're really good at it. They can really make a good sounding case. But when it comes to taking the rhetoric and distilling the argument with its evidence, even using Richard Dawkins' definition of rationality, this is something this is something else entirely.
That's right. And we could run a lot of different directions with this. One of them is I'm so thankful for homeschoolers who are teaching logic. I'm so thankful for Stand to Reason. I'm so thankful for anything that's out there in the marketplace where we're teaching people how to think, because we are short on that. And that's why people – that's got to be one of the reasons that people don't notice that this is pure rhetoric.
They don't know how to assess that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I had a little reflection coming this morning as I was thinking about our conversation, Tom, that we're going to have today. And it occurred to me there's a way that they can consistently or they have been persistently trying to get the word reason for themselves. And I think in a way fool themselves into thinking that they really are the guardians of reason. And it has to do with the way they define faith.
because it seems like they define faith almost universally. I mean, every single one of them, as a leap of religious wishful thinking.
Right.
So faith is a leap, and it's a leap towards something religious. Now, they don't think they take any leaps, and they certainly aren't leaping towards something religious. So therefore, the word faith can never apply to them by definition. And therefore, the only other word that can apply or describe what they're doing is reason. We don't do the faith thing. Therefore, we do the reason thing. They're the only reasonable ones, and therefore they deserve the label reason. And here's the key. Even when they don't manifest rational thinking in the arguments they offer, they don't exemplify the skill of reasoning. They do exemplify the skill of rhetoric, but not the skill of reasoning. They just claim the ground by default.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a really good analysis. And they have, I have had dictionary definitions pulled out on me where I have said, no, your definition of faith is not the way Christians experience
right.
faith. And they say, well, I'm going to the dictionary, I'm pointing at the dictionary, and Tom, the way you understand faith is wrong because it's not in a dictionary.
Well,
and then they come around and, okay, the dictionary's in charge now.
Uh-huh.
I can't describe my own experience.
Right. Well, you know, there's a sense where, look, language is conventional. Language is based on how people define things, but if you're going, and how people use the words. But if you're going to go after a Christian's point of view, you can't refute something else. You can't kind
right.
of trade on the dictionary's definition when
right.
this isn't the view that you happen to hold, Tom. If somebody's going to challenge your view, they got to deal with your view, not somebody else's view.
Right. But we're touching on two things here, which I think are really strategically crucial for us as Christians. We're touching on the sense of Christianity being regarded as bad, and we're touching on the idea of logic and reason and faith. And as I look at, as you mentioned earlier, I'm a strategist, and as I look at the big picture of where Christianity stands in this country, we're in a position of weakened credibility,
mm-hmm.
and it's because, to a great extent, in the public eye, we are bad and we are stupid.
Mm-hmm.
We are bad. And we have lost the moral high ground in the sense that we are we're the ones who are against the equal rights and of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
We're the ones who are against the woman's right to choose. We're against all these good things.
Mm-hmm.
So we're bad.
Mm-hmm.
And we've lost the intellectual high ground for a lot of reasons in the sense that people don't take us seriously on an intellectual level.
Mm-hmm.
And what I dream of and what I would love to see the church do is say, here are two problems that we can solve. And it's not going out and sharing your faith with your neighbor. That's good. But the church needs to take a longer, deeper, harder look at what's making our environment the way it is, and that is that we have got to recover the moral and intellectual high
mm-hmm.
ground.
Mm-hmm.
Those are strategic issues, and they're not going to be solved in a witnessing seminar, as much as I believe in witnessing
mm-hmm.
seminars.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to work on that level.
Yeah,
that's
those,
some of what we're trying to accomplish with what we're doing in these initiatives.
Yeah, well, what you said, just to go back to two statements, really good. This is perception. We are bad. We are stupid.
Right.
I actually don't think we're very bad, though we've been characterized that way. But I do think that the church has postured in a stupid way in the way that they dealt with a lot of things. They've been anti-intellectual.
Sure.
You know this. And there's a big turnaround in that. And I think I mentioned the third column. Actually, that meeting that night in Charlotte in the fall,
mm-hmm.
I had just been thinking about it. It just kind of congealed for me, and I mentioned it then. And I think that Ratio Christi and Stand to Reason and a lot of different organizations are involved in generating that third column and making the boots on the ground, thousands, yea, millions of thoughtful Christians capable of having a greater impact. But so we are dealing with that, and we've got a lot of work to do. I am not convinced. I think that can be corrected. I don't know if we can correct very easily the public perception that we are bad, partly because if we are going to be consistent followers of Christ, there are certain wildly politically incorrect positions right. that we are obliged to stand for. And here I think about a guy like Kirk Cameron, and I don't know if you know Kirk. You know who he is, right?
Sure.
Kirk was on Piers Morgan 2 weeks ago, and Kirk is a fabulous ambassador for Christ. But and I know Kirk. He lives in my neighborhood, basically, and so we get together on occasion, and he, the guy is a true blue, you know? And he gets up and he makes his case, and he argues for Christianity, and when he asked about homosexuality, he gives the truth in a gracious fashion, and then he is pilloried up and down the web, and, you know, for the last week as being this hateful person when everything about him is grace and charity and the way he comports himself and communicates. So if you don't have the right point of view, you're going to be labeled as hateful and spiteful regardless of what your character is like. It seems that that's the way it's going to be, or it is right now. And I don't have a lot of confidence that it's going to change much, even if we really mind our P's and Q's.
I have one ray of hope or maybe one avenue of hope on that, which is that the moral high ground to retake that is partly a matter of us doing the right thing. And it, you know, it has to do with, you know, there are some genuine scandals in the church, and we should be on guard against those kinds of things. But the rest of, there's another side to the moral high ground problem, which is an intellectual high ground problem, which is we need to be able to explain credibly why our moral position is at least worthy of listening to. I don't know if we'll get agreement, but I would like to have it be at least credible enough to be on the table for discussion.
Well, I would like that. I think that having traffic in the two biggest moral issues, and that would be abortion and homosexuality and all its various themes like same-sex marriage, I think it is actually almost ridiculously simple to make the case against abortion, and it is really, really hard to make the case against homosexuality. Not that it can't be made, but it requires some refined thinking and careful attention to particular details and a line of argument that most people aren't willing to give the time to.
That's and very difficult. I agree.
I just think it's a harder issue, and it's easier for a same-sex marriage kind of couple to say, we just want what's fair, and that sounds like so reasonable, but it takes you 15 minutes to really work through and explain why that's not the real issue. There's something much more deep and profound going on here, and even the notion of fairness presumes certain things that we have to take a closer look at. That, man, people don't have the patience for it or the capability. So I think you're right, Tom, about the moral issues. I got to go to break here in just a second. I think you're right about the moral issues. We can the intellectual issues, you know, we've got the goods. We can stand up and make the case, and you know, our guys are doing a stellar job, a fabulous job. In fact, you said that night in Charlotte that we don't need better arguments. The arguments have all been made ad nauseum on our side in favor of our view, that there's a strategic concern, and you're right. As far as the moral issues are, I think we've made the arguments too, but they're harder, I think, to grasp, at least on some of these issues. And so even when we do a good job, you know, Jesus said we're still going to be called, you know, people are still going to hate us. So anyway, look, at stay with us, Tom. I'm going to come back for a final segment. We'll talk more about your wonderful book, True Reason, which is available for $2.99 at book.truereason.org. And it's a great read. By the way, is this coming out ever in print version, or can I just print this out? Because I don't like flipping pages on a screen.
Well, yeah, we had to do it in a hurry, and we are assessing whether to get it in print, and I sure hope so.
I do too. There's just something just about holding a, for me, for nonfiction, I've got to have it in my hand. I got to be able to draw on it and mark it and bend the pages and put markers
right.
and all that other stuff.
Well, I hope so.
Okay, we'll be back with Tom Gilson and the book True Reason in just a moment. Stay with us and stand to reason.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android Market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Are homosexuals going to hell? Find out the answer by downloading my latest podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann, from iTunes or the podcast page at STR.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Segment here on Stand to Reason, my guest Tom Gilson, and he has assembled a book called True Reason. I say assembled because it's right now just in digital form, but it's only $2.99, and there's a lot of great stuff in here. As I mentioned, Tom, earlier, I haven't read the whole thing, but on the airplane coming back from our cruise yesterday, I did Melinda put it on my iPad, you know, so I had to do the iPad thing before the battery ran out. But and I like the book in hand, but it sure is great to have this accessible at a very modest price, $2.99. Say $3 for the book, and there's 18 to make that 16 chapters, covering a lot of ground here. But the stuff that I read, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's great because of it is meant to show that the people of reason that are claiming the ground of reason or the label reason are not exemplifying that. And what I said earlier, and I'll just repeat this because I do think it is a good way of looking at it. They define faith as unreasonable. Since they don't have that kind of religious faith, then they are, by definition, the reasonable people, and therefore they do not have to demonstrate skill at reasoning in the way they argue. They have simply claimed the label reason by default, by disqualifying us from it the way they define it. So it's all it's just a trick of language at this point.
It's a very neat little trick they do, and that lets them get away with all kinds of carelessness.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the little email exchange that you had with the organizer of this event yesterday, and in which you were actually told that you are not allowed to come and have conversation, and if there was a threat of being ushered away by security if you tried to come and talk with some people at the mall there in Washington D.C. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'll let my email get away from me on that one, so I'm going to pull it up. But first of all, this was an exchange that began when I. I contacted David Silverman, who's the president of American Atheists, and wondered if our True Reason group could co-sponsor with him a debate between William Lane Craig and Richard Dawkins. Of course, I know the history of that, but with Professor Craig's blessing on it, we decided to ask the question one more time. Well, Silverman, when he wrote back, he didn't pay much attention to that at all, except for my as more of an afterthought. He wrote to me, and he said it's an event by and for the non-religious population and their supporters, not an opportunity for Christians to push themselves into other people's lives yet again. I would never support infiltrating a Christian event with atheists on some kind of recruitment mission. That would be horribly rude. Make no mistake, you are not welcomed guests at the rally. We are not going to D.C. for, quote, dialogue with people who believe ridiculous things. We are going to have fun with other like-minded people. Now, let me jump in here. He goes on to talk about what will happen about if, you know, if we interfere, we'll be escorted to the First Amendment pen by security. This is... you know, he talks about going there to have fun with like-minded people. They had music, but it was not a concert and a dance. This was on the National Mall with the Washington Monument behind the stage in full view, public property. It was designed for the purpose of influencing public policy, that one of their purposes was legislative equality. Now, how likely is it that any other public policy-oriented event on the National Mall would be met with no contrary view there on the fringe? He was distorting the meaning of the event when he said that, that we shouldn't come. He was distorting it maybe in his own mind. But you don't tell people to stay away from a public policy event in the United States.
Yeah, well, I have this citation in front of me, too, because you published this piece at Thinking Christian, which people can go and see your article there. By the way, what's the URL for that? Is that
thinkingchristian.net.
Okay, and so Tom Gilson has this piece called Reason Rally Organizer to Reasoning Christians, We Want No Dialogue. That's the title. So you can get all the details there. But I notice he says in his email, he says, those who proselytize or interfere with our legal and well-deserved enjoyment will be escorted to the First Amendment pen by security.
Right.
Now, what's curious about this is that they're not obliged to go to the First Amendment pen themselves to make their statements about atheism. And, you know, both of us respect their right to have this event there on the mall. But he says it's our legal right to do so. But Tom, it's your legal right to show up on the mall and engage them in conversation as well. It is less your legal
question.
Right to do it. Yeah,
right. So they act as if it's in as if we should be worried that our rights are in question there. And you know, we checked with the National Park Service, and we knew exactly what was okay and what wasn't, and we were well within the bounds of it. We were just going there to talk with people. That's what we went there to do. That's what we did, and it was perfectly okay.
Well, no permit is needed to talk on the mall, conversation on the mall, which is what, and you were very clear in this piece and in your communication with him. I love this piece. It's the soul of civility here, the way you've written, and then not only that, but answered the challenges that he's offered. So this is in your piece at thinkingchristian.com, or make that thinkingchristian.net. But there's another detail here that is curious to me, and that is, even though that you were told that you are not allowed to show up for the purpose of saying anything or you would be ushered away by security, because this was, the implication here, a private event where they didn't want dialogue, that isn't entirely true then, is it? Because there was an invitation that was given to a Christian group by the organizer of the event itself. Tell us about it.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true. What you're referring to is the very infamous and controversial Westboro Baptist Church that got an invitation, a very warm invitation. It didn't come from the top rally organizers.
Okay.
It came from a sponsoring group. I don't know how they define their different roles there, but called the National Atheist Party. They were one of the atheist groups sponsoring the organization, and one of their executives wrote a very warm and welcoming message: stop by and socialize, and you don't miss this historic event. And he invited them to come. Well, yeah, that was little hard to fit together with the welcome that we didn't receive.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they came from different levels of planning,
mm-hmm.
and even though I suspect David Silverman was unhappy that Westboro got invited,
mm-hmm.
That had already happened before he and I had our email exchange, and he ought to have at least felt a little uncomfortable telling us what he did after
uh-huh.
that.
In light of that. Okay, well, I'm glad you clarified that issue. I mean, my first impression was that Silverman had issued that invitation. But in any event, I can see why it's obvious to me why an atheist group would not be troubled whatsoever to have the Westboro Baptist group show up. Was that the name of it, Westboro Baptist?
Yeah.
To show up because they're such a poor representative of our view. It's mm-hmm. only going to serve to make their view look better. But Melinda mentioned earlier that one of the things that she's observed is that, again, the same theme. These folks don't seem to characteristically want to talk with the best of our side that want to give the reasons and rationale for our point of view. And even when Sam Harris debated Bill Craig last summer on the issue of morality, this was clarified and detailed in one of the chapters in your book, True Reason. He did not at all engage any of the points that Bill Craig had offered. So just another example of just avoiding the real issues.
Yeah, he ducked it completely, and it was, I wrote that chapter, and it was, he is the head of Project Reason,
mm-hmm.
and the way I saw that was that Bill Craig and he showed up to reason, but he didn't reason. It would be a lot like as if they were at a baseball game and Sam Harris were Project Baseball, Mr. Baseball, and Craig was at bat, and there were three men on base, and he hits a long fly ball to the outfield and will win the game unless Harris catches the ball. All he has to do is catch the ball. What does Sam Harris do? He puts a football on the ground and attempts a field goal. In other words, this was a reasoning event, and he wears the name Reason, but he didn't play that game. He played a different game.
Right. Well, that chapter that you wrote, I had forgotten you wrote it, was a superb chapter, and I commend it and the rest of the book to my listeners. It's called True Reason. It's an e-book available for $3 at book.truereason.org. It's a terrific answer to the folks at the Reason Rally yesterday and any like them. Tom, thank you for putting the hard work together in 3 months to get this available to us. You did a great job.
It was a fun project. And again, my hat's off to the team. You can't do these things alone.
Mm-hmm. Look forward to next time I see you, Tom.
And you too. Thank you.
Okay, all the best. Tom Gilson, True Reason is the title of the book, available at book.truereason.org. I had a great time reading it yesterday on the airplane until my battery ran out on my iPad. But I commend it to you, ladies and gentlemen. And there's our music, so that's the end of our show. I want to thank you for listening. It's been a joy. Remember, this is Stand to Reason, and we represent an attempt to reason carefully about the most important things. Whether we are successful in your mind or not is a decision you have to make, but we will do the job. Thank you for listening, friends. I'm Greg Kokel. You go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.